Everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is, what day is it? 7th of September. I wasn't sure what the number was. Sorry.
Numbers are important, Nick.
I'm professional and prepared.
The number is arbitrary, Nick. You don't need to know that.
What
does 7 really mean, man? Like, it's just a thing that says something.
It's a movie that people memetically quote. I know that much.
Yeah, like, it's just a movie when you think about it. So what if you didn't remember the name of a number/movie? It's fine.
Who cares? Doesn't matter.
You think Kevin Spacey will judge you for it? Man, he's cool with everything.
Have you seen some of the stuff he's in? He's a talking cat now.
Yeah, dude, he's fucking doing talking cat movies with Christopher Walken. Dude's fucking chill. You can do whatever.
Christopher Walken's in that movie?
Yeah, he plays...
Jesus Christ.
He plays, like, a fucking Asian shop owner who, like, gives him the mystical cat that causes it all. Like, you know the character he played in Click?
Yes.
All that? He's essentially the exact same character. They just don't connect them at all. But he works out of, like, an Asian knick-knack store, essentially, and he gives him, like, the magic cat that transforms him into a cat.
Did you ever see that movie Balls of Fury that he was in?
Yes. I have seen more of that than I care to admit.
It is good. Honestly, I don't think that movie is as bad as it deserves to be.
There's a couple decent lines in it.
There's a couple decent bits in it here and there. But, where he plays the villain of the movie, and he's dressed up like the Asian Kung Fu master.
It must just be like a treat for him every day he gets to do it. He's like, oh, I can't wait.
I get to be in this.
He's like, I can't wait to be Furious Mingy today. And I'm just like, oh, man, I wish I could grow up to be Christopher Walken. I'm so close, I've half the name.
Anyway. I don't know how I was going to start this episode off originally, but now I'm talking about Christopher Walken.
We found a better way.
We found a better one. It's no longer Bloggist, Chris. We have said goodbye to Bleach. I'm sure we will never talk about it on the podcast again.
Never. We've never
even so much as bring it up in passing ever again.
It's never going to be brought up again, ever.
No. But we have some other stuff to talk about on what I have unofficially dubbed September gear. But,
oh, man.
But that's coming much later. I did start reading that series. I think that it started off stupid enough. I can't wait for it to get even worse.
Oh, the beginning's actually good. The beginning's what I liked. In comparison to what's to come, you're like, well, this has logical sense and follows a train of thought.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it makes perfect sense the way that he, had firecrackers shoved up his ass. Anyway. Yeah.
It's crude, it's awful, it's weird, but at least it's not nearly as dumb as it gets later on, with everything else then on top of it.
But we have another suggestion, which we took. It's time to continue our second set of adventures, Chris. We've done the second JoJo series. It's time to do the second Pokemon Adventures set.
Yes.
With the Gold and Silver and Crystal chapters.
Yes. Based off of the fourth best region in Pokemon.
Well, there's going to be 7 now, so...
I'd say 4th still, probably.
Just based on what we've seen from...
Hold on a sec. I think I forgot to take down the our covers. Continue on. Sorry about that.
That's all right. We'll just open up the YouTube so with no one knowing what kind of rude gestures we were showing to the camera.
I feel...
I was actually going to ask you about that, because this is the Gold and Silver chapters. What are your feelings on the Gold and Silver games?
As games, I like them a lot. I mean, it's the only game that ever really incorporated the previous region at all. Like, even though it was kind of a bare-bones way, you didn't have things to do in Kanto except go to gyms directly, beat the gym leader, go on to next, essentially. There really wasn't a plot at that point.
There wasn't a second adventure to go on, like, where you had done whatever the fuck was going on in JoJo.
Yeah, it was like, You're like, I took care of Team Rocket, and I thank God there's not another fucking head of Hydra over here, head of Team Rocket to take down.
There's no more executives.
Yeah. But that said, Johto, a lot of people credit as being like kind of their favorite Generation 2. I honestly don't care for Generation 2 all that much. I think there are some decent Pokemon in it, but a lot of them I don't care for. I never really liked baby Pokemon as an addition to the franchise. Like, they always just seemed like an annoying add-on. Like, I'm just like, God damn it, I fucking caught a Magby. Now I have to grind this thing's happiness up so I can make it a worthwhile goddamn Magby.
No, Magby, you just have to get to level 30 in order to get turned into Magby.
That's right. It was...
It's like Eaglybuff and Cleffa and Pichu.
Shit like that.
And,
like, fuck this nonsense.
And then they got crazier with, like, this one can hatch from an egg, but only if you give it... Incense. If you have one of them hold the proper...
Incense.
Incense. Only then will it seed.
The fucking specific horseshit that it's the incense. It's like, oh, well, I want an Azumarill. What do you have to do? It's like, oh, well, do I give it sea incense or wave incense? Like, they're so fucking close together in name. You can't, like, decipher which one's which without looking at a guide. I'm like, God, fuck this nonsense.
How are you supposed to figure this out without going on Bulbapedia?
Seriously.
That was when it started getting really crazy, was like Gen 3 and beyond. Like, who would think, like, you know, oh, you have to get its beauty up enough in order to get one of the best water Pokemon in the game.
That was pretty cool, I thought. But
that was pretty cool. They do that really well in Adventure, but getting ahead of myself.
In regards, though, to Johto, I always thought it had the most boring region. Like, there... It was the least plot of any of the games. It was
absolutely
the first game, but with a lamer version of Team Rocket, because there wasn't Giovanni.
There was no Giovanni. It was just, you know, the remains. You know, the Team Rocket admins are going to be your final boss. That's it.
And even the gym leaders just really, they're not very memorable, a lot of them.
Like, some of them are good.
There's some okay ones, but...
Well, honestly, we're going to get into it, but I think that, like, the most forgettable gym leader of all time ends up having the most plot-relevant role out of all of them.
That's tough, considering, like,
it's... Well, there's a lot to choose from. Honestly, Pokemon Adventure does a lot to help the gym leaders out for Johto.
Yeah, it's like if someone put a gun to my head and it's like, name all the gym leaders in Pokemon, I'd be cruising so well, and then I'd get to Johto, and I'd be like, oh, fuck, they're... Bug guy? Shit! There's a bird dude, right?
I think that, I think the Bugsy people remember because, like, everyone got confused over what his gender was supposed to be originally. Whitney people remember because she's a crybaby, I think.
Because she's a fucking whore. That's why. Fuck Whitney.
I always liked Jasmine. And she stands out because she has the steel type, so she was the only one who actually, of the gym leaders in Johto, who used a Johto type.
Yeah.
And I think people are all right on Claire, because she used dragons.
Claire, she's
but
also,
even so.
She's also a bitch who's like, oh, you beat
I'm
me.
I'm not going to give you the badge. Yeah. No.
You have to do
until,
another
like,
thing.
Her elder comes up and is like, bitch, give him the badge.
Yeah, you're the eighth gym leader. You're supposed to be the gym leader that inspires respect amongst your colleagues. And you're the one who's like, I can't believe I lost. So you have to find me in my cave. I'm like, this is fucking nonsense.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, Faulkner. Like, who the fuck remembers Faulkner? He's the first gym leader. He's easily the most forgettable first gym leader out of the entire franchise.
He's only unique to me because he's one of the first gym leaders that isn't a rock-type guy. Because after all, like, later on, it just became rock-type.
Roark and Roxanne. I guess that, I mean, they did change things up in Gen 5 where they were like, the one you have to battle is the one who has a type that is advantageous against your own type. It's like, you fucker.
Yeah, you're like, oh, you got me.
You dicks. But yeah, I don't miss your point. And looking back, I definitely do tend to agree with that. Johto is kind of forgettable. The region's not particularly interesting because it's just kind of like a slightly less advanced version of Kanto. Uh-huh. There is, you know, a lot more like kind of traditional style buildings, a lot more rural areas, and that's kind of it. But at the same time, it feels like an updated beta version of the first gen. there were so many problems with the original set of games.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Gen 2 basically is like the first working Pokemon game. So I think it deserves a lot of credit for that. In terms of, they fixed a bunch of stuff, decided we can't introduce new Pokemon. Here's some more Eevee evolutions.
Maybe we should nerf psychic types a little bit. Introduce some ghost types that also aren't poison types.
Balance stuff out. Introduced like a more balanced type system in general by adding the new types. Gave more of a sense of like type specialty by having, you know, like, oh, steel is the type that doesn't really have any offensive advantages against, except against fucking rock. But it's got all these different things that it's immune to. And also, I think that it's just kind of cool to be able to just revisit it. And, I like the feeling that you get when you go back to Kanto and see how things have changed, where it's like, well, Koga's one of the Elite Four now, and his daughter is now the new gym leader. Gary took over as the new gym leader of Viridian. Red is like this silent, mysterious badass who hangs out in Mount Silver isolated from everyone else. Like, his appearance in that game is basically how people perceive Red to be.
Yeah, he's like a mythological figure in the Pokemon games. And it's, again, it's the only situation where that ever has occurred, because you've never encountered your former protagonist in any of the future games. It's the only time anything like that happened.
So it makes Gen 2 unique from the other games, because it's very much this is a sequel. And I'm glad that none of the other games are like that, because can you imagine if, like, we got to, you know, to Sinnoh, and it's like, and the newest branch of Team Rocket is here!
Oh, man.
They might all still technically just be knockoffs of Team Rocket, but at least they've got different gimmicks and different goals.
Different plots, you know, different themes, yeah.
So, and, I mean, I've got nostalgic feelings attached to the games because Gold was the first game that I actually played all the way through. I did have Yellow before that, but I got stuck at the Elite Four because I hadn't leveled my party properly. So I never actually finished a Gen 1 game when I was a kid. But Gen 2 was a game that I finished. I've got a lot of nostalgic feelings attached to that and how I steamrolled the Elite Four because it was midway through the game as opposed to at the end. And so I did have a lot of nostalgic feelings attached to Gold and Silver, and I think that that's probably why Gold is my favorite protagonist in the Pokemon Adventure series, is just sheer, like, starting off favoritism. But, I guess that wraps up, like, pre-existing feelings, so I guess we'll just get into this now. But yeah, Gold and Silver, based on the Gold and Silver games, not too surprising. And yeah, it takes place in Johto, and I guess to start off with the new protagonists, you've got Gold, who is essentially your protagonist from the Gen 2 games, you've got Silver, who's the rival, the guy who stole his starter, and you've got Crystal, who is the female protagonist, who was actually the first female protagonist that the games introduced.
Yes.
The way that
she's the first, I guess, canon female character in this manga, since Green was an entirely original creation. She's not.
Right, she didn't actually come around until Fire Red, Leaf Green. Right. The way that I would most quickly sum them up, I think, and you might disagree with me on this, you know more about this than I do. Gold is Team Instinct. Silver is Team Mystic, and Crystal is Team Valor.
Man, I don't want to be fucking with Team fucking Gold. He sucks. He's a douche.
He is an asshole. I love him. Gold is the most prototypical shonen protagonist out of, I think, any of the leads in Pokemon Adventure. He goes about things at his own pace, doesn't really care too much for other people. Things will happen to other people. And unless he perceives the problem to actually be really important, he'll just be like, I don't care about that. I've got more important shit to do. And then when he ends up helping them out, he'll act like he was this wonderful hero the whole time. Like, well, I think that something that happens is this guy is riding on a Dawn fan and he has like stolen somebody's bag or purse. So they're like, oh, help us stop him. Miguel's like, I got other shit to do. I'm not going to stop him. And I forget what actually sets him off.
I think it's like a shop owner who says, like, I'll give you free food if you help or something. Like he has to get like a personal incentive.
Or the Donphan owner might have actually pissed him off by something completely unrelated. So he ends up stopping him. And then when he's been rewarded back in town, he's like, well, when I saw an innocent person in trouble, I knew I just had to jump in. Everyone around him was just like, no, you didn't, you little asshole.
Oh, yeah, he buys a rice cake. The Don fans like, knock it out of his hand and stomp on it. And then the shop owner won't give him a new one. Like, he's just like, God damn it!
Reason. you robbed me of my meal, fuck you. He is constantly goofing around. He plays these gambling games, like he's got a billiards gimmick. He tends to launch his Pokeballs with a pool cue.
It's done in really interesting ways, too. Like, it's, again, if you're somebody who's never read the manga before, and you've only played the games, you're kind of going into this, or you've been watching the anime, you have to kind of, like, accept that the manga follows different rules, so, like, humans are actually almost as much of a part of battling as the Pokemon are, so, like, you don't just throw a Pokeball into a big square and there's a fight. Like, he actually will knock the Pokeball into a certain direction so that when the Pokemon comes out, it's in a particular advantageous position, or, like, it opens up in a way that the Pokemon coming out will cause something to trigger. Like, it's a lot of very innovative ways to essentially use the Pokeball opening mechanic.
Gold's the trickster of this set. He's essentially kind of like Green was in the original. Not quite as underhanded as she was, but he's actually established, if you look at the levels of the Pokemon and the volume extras and stuff, he's established to be the weakest of the three in this set. He's not the best battler and he's not the best trainer, but he uses this tricky approach in order to get an advantage on people. And he's actually not like, he doesn't have a particularly good record with battling either.
No, he loses quite a lot, actually.
He doesn't take on the gym challenge. He's essentially just runs up against the same two opponents over and over and just loses them over and over. He goes up against Silver and loses constantly. And he goes up against the series villain and loses constantly.
He also loses against Whitney when they're doing a contest, or he was going to lose until Sudowoodo interferes.
Right. But he's got this tricky approach to stuff that in the end ends up paying huge dividends for him. And I think that that's part of why I like him is because he's, I'm not sure exactly what the word is, but he's different than you would expect a protagonist of this series to be, I think. He's not particularly noble and he's not particularly straightforward. And that makes
he's the Eddie Guerrero, you know?
He's like Eddie Guerrero.
Who kind of cheats and uses, like, just like, actually like Joseph, too, from Part 2, where it's a character who kind of uses feints and trickery as part of their style, but they're still a hero. And Gold is, like, a fun character to follow. He does feel like he has a lot more personality than, like, Red did, for example. Like, there's a little just bit more to him.
There's this great, he's also got this great bit, because people know that he's a lying asshole, but he just kind of keeps on going. Like, he never fools anyone or tricks anyone, and that makes him more endearing in terms of that side of his personality than anything else. Because his lies are so transparent, and his trickery is so straightforward, that no one really gets hurt by it unless they deserve it. There's a bit towards the beginning, because it starts off kind of similar to the way the games do, in terms of Professor Elm has his three starter Pokemon that he's going to entrust along with, you know, three Pokedex holders, but Silver steals one of them, the same way that he does in the games. But this time, instead of being, you know, Professor Elm's trusted helper from the beginning of the games, Gold is just kind of passing through.
Yeah.
Just kind of stumbles into the situation, and so he gets pissed off at Silver. And so he decides to go after him. And in doing so, he ends up with the Cyndaquil. And Silver ends up with the Totodile. And so Cyndaquil and Gold go after Silver in order to get Totodile back. And Elm ends up getting contacted with Gold later on and asking him, oh, well, Cyndaquil's gone missing too. And Gold is just like, yeah, okay, I gotta tell you what's going on. Yeah, your Totodile was stolen and we haven't been able to catch up with him yet. Also, this guy is with me for some reason. I'm not really sure. Anyway, we're going after them.
It's a lot of craziness at the start. You do, you know, for as much of the silliness and the kind of edge you get to Gold, you also do see that he's like a, you know, caring trainer, because for his whole thing is he has a whole bunch of Pokemon at the start who are essentially his family. Like, it's just his house Pokemon, essentially. They all take care of him.
He grew up with Pokemon.
And the big thing is that, like, kind of triggers him to go after Silver is they get stolen, and he believes it's Silver that did it. So he's kind of hunting after them and going after him for that reason. And you do get to see the lengths he'll go to for these Pokemon, even though they're not, he doesn't see, like, work with them in a trainer Pokemon kind of relationship per se. He considers them his family, which kind of helps to play into his ultimate character arc a bit.
And one of the things I like about him is that they really do kind of play up that he has more heart for Pokemon than they does for people, but he's very genuine about it. Because Totodile eventually becomes more partners with Silver than his tool. And so when they end up confronting, I think he's evolved into Croconaut by this point, when they confront Silver and have a battle, Gold realizes, well, he's not being, you know, a slave to him. He actually wants to go along with Silver on this. So he speaks with his Cyndaquil, and he's like, I don't think that he wants to come back with us anymore. So I'm sorry, you know, I don't think we can bring him back because he doesn't want to leave. And so if that's what he wants, there's nothing we can do about it. So he cares, you know, it's not like, oh yeah, Professor Elm, I swear I'll get your Pokemon back. It's, well, we'll do what that Pokemon wants.
Yeah.
And when he sees that, he's like, okay, we'll just kind of let it go then.
Now, I will say, I was not a crazy big fan of Gold, if only because, not to dig into spoilers or anything, but it's essentially a point in the story where Gold stops being the main character. Like, there's a couple volumes, and then it stops. And when he comes back into it, basically, when he stops being the protagonist, it's Crystal's time to be entered into the story.
Right.
And not to jump ahead to her, but I fucking love Crystal. She's the best fucking character in the goddamn...
I was really curious.
She is so cool. And the moment Gold comes back into the story, he just spontaneously becomes a super big dick to her.
He's got away with women, doesn't he?
He's just like, out of nowhere, he's just like, Miss Prissy over here doesn't want to get involved. And she's just like, Prissy. And then, like, they're riding off somewhere, and he's like, you should stop eating donuts or you're going to get fat. She's like, why? Why?
He is 11.
I was just like, why? What? She's so cool. Why aren't you enamored with her the same way I am?
Well, the thing is, I'm pretty sure he is enamored with her.
I didn't quite get... It was just like a moment where I'm just like, you're a douche. Crystal's awesome. Fuck you. Go back to her being the lead. She kicks Pokeballs at people.
I was very curious what you were going to think of Crystal, because in the same way that we were both kind of like, Yellow's kind of a Mary Sue. When I first started reading the series, someone who was more familiar with it than I was like, God, Crystal, that freaking Mary Sue. And I can sort of see it. I can sort of see it. Because she comes in and she's immediately she's the Pokemon catching expert. She's introduced independently from Gold and Silver, who have this thing going on where Gold is chasing after Silver. Silver's got his own mission, and Gold is kind of getting involved with it as he's pursuing after him. But Crystal is introduced independently. Mm-hmm. Because basically, Oak is like, well, I need someone to help actually, you know...
He's like,
the Pokedex thing, the thing that I've been trying to do for several years. I need someone to catch Pokemon so that I can, you know... gather info for the Pokedex.
The two Pokedexes that were stolen by me before are being used by some fucking Nundit kids who don't do anything with it. They don't catch shit.
So she comes in, and she is introduced as the catching expert. And holy shit is she.
Well, that's what I think immediately got me on board with her, is she felt very unique and distinct among the world. It's something that kind of gets revealed later on, that everyone in the series, including the protagonists in the first one, all kind of have the thing that they are.
They have an expertise associated with being a Pokemon trainer.
But hers is very clear and distinct from the moment you meet her. They say she's the catching expert, and she's very good at catching Pokemon. But it's not just that. her entire team is based around catching Pokemon. So her team fits this theme. She has a very unique style of catching Pokemon where she uses her legs for everything. So she'll actually kick Pokeballs and like drop kick Pokeballs to like catch people. And she has a lot of like very, like a lot of great skill towards us. And I can understand why maybe some people might be like, oh, she's so good at everything, because I guess you didn't necessarily get that with Gold, and there's not really enough to Silver to compare them to at that point. But the thing that I think works for her is, after a short little bit after she's introduced, is when, and I'm going to fuck up the Pokemon's name, Suicune, is when Suicune kind of gets into the story. And this is actually a bit of a tangent, but Suicune gets involved in the story, and for like two volumes just fucking wanders around beating up gym leaders. Like, that's sort of...
searching for his battle partner, Chris.
It takes, like, two volumes, and, like, it's this weird diversion from things. But she's going after Suicune, and it's a big part of her character that she wants to catch Suicune, and also trying to understand Suicune, and isn't able to, because Suicune has very high standards. So she actually has, like, a character arc in a moment where she completely loses confidence with herself and has to recover. Now, it's something she does in a couple chapters or so, but you actually see her...
Her mother comes in and slaps her, and then leaves and is never seen again.
Yeah, I didn't know who it was at first, and I'm glad they're like, oh, Mom! But, like, it's like a well-done moment that shows you the vulnerability she has, so you're able to relate to her as a human, and it helps make all of her fantastic feats and everything else like that much more awesome in comparison, too, because you're like, she's not completely broken. Like, it's a person with feelings and things like that. She just worked her ass off to get to this point, and I think it's really cool. She feels unique in the world. It's not just another trainer. She's Crystal, the catching expert, with a whole team based around that.
And has a rival who I think is one of the best characters in this arc, Yusine.
Yeah.
He's this weird, eccentric guy who's also trying to catch Suicune, and they're trying to catch him at the same time. They develop this kind of relationship and understanding between each other, this friendly rivalry of sorts, where he's like, no, I'm going to be the one to catch Suicune, and he's got these special tools that help him as well. And he ends up helping out in the final conflict when he comes in at the end, too. But he's just got this really entertaining personality that I quite like, where he's just like, I am here to catch the Pokemon.
He's just always, he thinks he's like the most worthy trainer for Suicune, when you're just like, you're an idiot.
Well, the best moment of character development I can think of for him is he ends up landing in this barn from a high distance. And he comes to, and people are like, what are you doing here, stranger? He's like, oh God, I really need somewhere to recover and rest and get some food for tonight. Can I stay here? Like, you just crashed through the roof. What are you doing? He's like, aha. Well, I see that your meal tank over here is sick. Well, I am a wonderful magician, and I know how to cure it. So, ha-ha! He does this trick, and miraculously the meal tank is cured. And they're like, oh my gosh, you're a miracle worker. Yes, here, have all this stuff from us. And Crystal comes up to him and is like, you just did a quick trick where you just, you know, put a berry in its mouth. And that was it. Like, all you had to do was just give the meal tank a berry.
Yeah, basically.
Why did you bother with the deception?
He tries to act like there's something stuck in the milk tank's mouth that he pulls out, but instead he's just putting the berry in.
Right.
And she's like, what the fuck?
Like, yeah, why did you do that?
No need for the deception, and I hate dishonest people like that.
Mm-hmm. And he's kind of one of those things where he's got this weird trickster personality, but he also... he helps Crystal, too.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that he had been involved more in the story. Like, I wish that he had kind of...
I honestly forgot he was a part of the story until he showed up again at the end. I was like, oh, right! You were, like, a weird plot thread for a while.
And then I think that the biggest weakness of this set of chapters is the focus jumps around a bit too much. It all comes together at the end, but it feels like... You start off with one thing, then you move to another thing, then you move to another thing, and then follow up on a couple of things from two of the threads, and at the very end they all come together. As opposed to kind of setting them all in motion and building them all gradually on top of one another.
It's a narrative that does come together in a very strong and powerful way, but it is one that initially is very non-existent. And in fact, for most of the time that Gold is like the main protagonist and really the only one in the series, Silver's just kind of a rival there, there really isn't a plot. Like, eventually you start meeting the Mask of Ice, and he's there every now and then, and you see hints of Team Rocket, but it's not enough to be a plot. Like, the whole point is still gold traveling, trying to find silver, that sort of thing.
Once you get to about halfway through, that's where the plot really starts to emerge.
Yeah, but then it switches over, and we start getting the Suicune going after all the gym leaders, trying to find a worthy trainer stuff, and it bounces around. You're you know, with Crystal one moment, the next it's like, oh, hey, we're with fucking Falconer and Chuck on Mahogany Island, and Suicune's gonna show up, and you're just like, oh, okay. And then after that, you don't see those two again for a really long time. It's just, it bounces around a lot, and then finally, basically once all the protagonists have kind of gathered together, that's when the actual plot, mm-hmm. like, kind of sinks itself in and just stays there throughout the rest of it. It works in a way, and it is, I think, actually a huge, it's a more cohesive story than I think the first part was, if only just because it feels like it flows a little bit more naturally, but it is something that still is a little bit of an oddity as you're reading through it.
This, like how the second gen of Pokemon games feels like the first working games to me, this is, I think, the first actual proper Pokemon Adventures story.
Yes.
Kind of like how, you know, JoJo didn't actually become JoJo until a couple of story arcs in. But there's a bunch of trademarks. First off, it gets the artist that it actually sticks with. Two volumes in, Pokemon Adventures suddenly switches artists. And while the art definitely wasn't bad to begin with, it becomes a lot easier to follow once it switches. Like, the art gets, the characters feel, like, more distinct. The action is just easier to follow. Like, when you first see Crystal's catching technique, you can tell the way that her body moves as she kicks the Pokeball. As opposed to, like, just before that, it was a little bit more difficult to follow.
You get some shots of her, like, kicking Pokeballs, and you can get, like, a real sense of excitement from it.
Mm-hmm. And another one of the things that comes from that is awesome, badass two-page spreads.
You do. It's, you get a lot of just badass moments from this series. Moments that I even have to look at, and I'm like, this is, it's lame that I'm excited this much for what
I'm seeing.
Oh my god,
it makes me feel like a kid. When I was reading through this story arc, I was going, yeah, this is pretty good, this is alright. And then it gets to the big finale, and it's like, holy shit, I'm like 12 again.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know why, I have that moment, even though I don't watch Power Rangers anymore, anytime I see a scene where like, 12 Power Rangers line up in a fucking line and little colored explosions go off behind them. I'm like, this is awesome! Why is it so awesome? I have that moment at the end of this where I'm like, I don't know why all these things happen. Like, I know why. I just feel like I shouldn't love it as much as I do, but god damn, this is cool.
You get moments towards the end series like, the villain has revealed themselves and all this stuff is coming out like, oh, this is what they were doing. This is how their plan worked and stuff. And Team Rocket is fighting everywhere, and the villain has Lugia and Ho-Oh under their control, and you're like, oh my god, what are we gonna do?
Oh.
And suddenly, Bill, the Pokemon Exchange...
Do we want to put spoilers at this point, just in case people are planning to read it?
Yeah, might as well.
Because I think this is an extremely cool moment. That's one that I think if you haven't read
the series, we haven't talked about Silver yet... But it's kind of impossible to talk about Silver without going into spoilers, because that's the only point when you actually find out about his character.
Yes.
Up until that point, he's just kind of like, I have a mission that I must go on.
He's nothing like the game version, so I'll just say that before we get into any spoilers. But yeah, if you're listening here, be aware, spoilers ahead. If you want to know a quick thought on what I thought of Gold and Silver, I think it's very good. If you read part one and liked it, you should really like part two. If you didn't care for part one, I think this greatly cements the formula in a much better way. It handles everything a lot better. All right, carry on.
So, the villains revealed themselves, and a recurring thing through the arc has been that Bill can't get the Pokemon. He can't get the PC to work. It's not the Pokemon Exchange network is down, so people can't send their Pokemon to each other. He finds out that they've actually been draining energy from it in order to power their machinations and stuff. So he gets it working again, and he sends out this call to people because he's been getting emails saying, "I wish that I could help in this battle against Team Rocket." And he's like, "You can. People, send us your Pokemon." And the fucking president of the Pokemon fan club gets this message. And he sends out a call to all the members of the Pokemon fan club. This doddering old man who doesn't like to battle is like, "We must help our friends! Send all our Pokemon out to help them!" And you get this massive two-page spread of this horde of Pokemon flying towards Ho-Oh and Lugia to fight them.
It's so awesome. Like, it's something done so many times. Earth, spend me your spirit energy. You know, like, hurry, kids of the world, send emails to clog up Omnimon. It's something done 1,000 times. For some reason, I thought this was the coolest thing. When it's like, everybody, send your Pokemon over to help fight against Ho-Oh and Lugia. And you just see this huge army gathered up behind, like, the main characters. It's freaking awesome.
Or even, like, right around the same time, because the protagonists from the previous series all start to come back into the fold, too. Gradually, they come back in order to join the conflict. And there's this moment where they're just standing down against the villain, and you get all the different protagonists with their starters behind them, with Raikou and Entei and Suicune behind them, just staring them down, ready to fight.
Yeah, it is very cool.
So let's talk about this insane-ass plot that happens.
Can I just cut right to the chase on this?
Go ahead.
Why on God's green earth do they drag out the identity of the Mask of Ice for so fucking long?
He's got ice powers, and he's one of the gym leaders. Oh, which of these 16 gym leaders uses ice Pokemon?
Let's say you know nothing about Pokemon. You've never played the game, so you don't know that Price is an ice-type gym leader. He's the only gym leader you don't meet for fucking ever in Johto. He's the last one they meet. Then you find out he has ice abilities, and you're like, well, that should be,
he's got
somehow
distinctly, like, intricate, all-powerful ice abilities. He makes people think that Suicune is in his gym.
Yeah.
When his ice sculptures, that's how convincing his ice powers are.
Yeah, he can make living sculptures of ice. So, again, immediately you should be like, oh, the Mask of Ice, there's a gym leader with ice powers, I should make that. Again, let's assume you can't. At the end of that little scene, he fucking basically admits to being an insidious motherfucker. And still, there are volumes that go by with every character being like, who is the masked man? Like,
and every time he does something that demonstrates his ability to use ice, he then kind of goes, I'm just an old man.
Yeah, like, oh, couldn't be me, cough, cough. Like, characters, like, chapters will end with someone being like, who's the masked man? Or someone being like, I know the identity of the masked man. Cut. Because it's like, well, we couldn't possibly know. I'm like, all you have to do is go back to that fucking page where he fucking has this insidious look. He might as well hold up a little sign to the reader. It's like, I'm the Mask of Ice! It's like, how long are you going to stretch this out? Now, he himself is cool, and I actually like what they did with Price, because they built up this conspiracy. It's a lot like the first game, where it's like, hey, we're going to take a gym leader, we're going to make him an antagonist, and you know, unlike the first one, it's not like four members, it's just him. He's the big one. And what's kind of cool about it is, once you finally get to his plot, once you get to why he's doing these evil machinations, it's actually a lot more, like, inventive than you would normally expect. Like, it's not just, I want to make all the earth in the world be bigger, like, you know, characters in the game. It's like an actual motivation. It's like, alright, I can get behind this. Like, I can see why this dude would go to this length for it. So I completely get that, and I think he actually works as it. I was just very fucking tired by, like, the sixth volume.
Mask of Ice!
I'm like, who could it be? It's like, you have literally 16 candidates! Start going through them!
So what happens is, in the first part, we just have kind of Gold going after Silver, but they encounter the mysterious Mask of Ice a couple of times. And you find out that the Mask of Ice is actually Silver's target. He's the one his missions are based around. Then they end up getting defeated by the guy, seemingly killed in the Lake of Rage. And so we cut to Crystal to have her adventures going after Suicune.
Yeah.
But Lieutenant Surge, of all people, ends up rescuing or trying to rescue Gold and Silver when he discovers them. And he actually gets kind of this whole redemption arc through the story.
Something I actually wanted to bring up, because all just like how Gen 2 was, this, I don't know if future parts do this at all, but it basically brings back all the characters from the first part. Some in very small
ways. Protagonists tend to get brought back in varying degrees at some point or another.
But with this, everyone comes back, and they don't come back in so much of a way to overbear on the story. A lot of them kind of come back just to show how the characters have changed, or to give, like, some closure to some stuff. Like, Blaine appears, and it gives a little bit more closure to the whole Mewtwo thing from the first part. Right. And I thought all that was done really well, and as you said, one of the big ones is Lieutenant Surge. He actually gets, like, a real redemption arc in this. Mm-hmm. Sabrina technically gets one. She doesn't do a lot.
She stood up in the hot springs and read Almost Sara Naked.
That is true. And she does completely fuck over Bugsy in their one-on-one match.
Like a boss.
Oh, she schools him.
Just destroys him.
That's the thing. That's when I really got invested in this. That's when I couldn't put down the manga. It was when they are like, we're going to do a Johto versus Kanto gym leader battle. We're going to have one-on-one matches to decide which region is best between the gym leaders. And I'm like, oh my god, the fucking 10-year-old boy inside of me is so excited right now. And Blaine gets to be a pivotal part of Team Kanto. He was going to be the captain until no one could get a hold of him.
Yeah, they did some really cool stuff with the Kanto gym leaders. I think that almost all of them have, like, a little thing going on. I think Brock, honestly, is, like, the one who's, like, got the least character stuff going on out of all of them, honestly. Yeah. Which is unusual. But, like, Misty is, like, dealing with, like, her emerging feelings for Red. Erica has been thrust into the role of team captain and has to deal with the responsibility of that. Surge has his redemption thing going on. Sabrina, they actually follow up on stuff that happened during Yellow's arc, where she got injured during the battle against the Elite Four. And so both she and Red are suffering from the same wrist injury. And Red, like they established, was going to be a gym leader if he didn't have this nagging injury. He took the test to become one, and he just concluded, I can't keep up with the strain of this until my hands are cured. And so he has to go to the secret hot springs where he can get the cure before he comes in to join the final battle.
It's pretty cool, too, because he actually wins the contest. He earned the shot to be a gym leader, but he's like, no, I'm not good enough. Like, I don't live up to my own standards, so I declined the position. It's like, oh, that's pretty cool. By the way, I just want to note, this is the scene I'm talking about with fucking Price. He's like, Suicune won't come to me, and with good reason. And it's like, this fucking face is not the face you try to pretend, like, who could be the Mask of Ice for so goddamn long?
But the reason we have this whole Kanto versus Johto gym battle is actually pretty clever, because essentially what they discover about the Mask of Ice is that there are these particles that are left behind at the side of battle which match up with gym leader badges. And so like, oh, the Mask of Ice must be a gym leader, so let's gather all the gym leaders together and have the very few people who have actually fought with the Mask of Ice observe the battle so that they can figure out who it is. Hint, it's the one with ice powers who completely wrecks Erica with ice powers.
Almost all of the gym battles, the one-on-one fights, are actually really cool. Like, a lot of them are kind of, like, contained within their own chapters and have, like, interesting mechanics to how they work.
I think that the least interesting one is Missy just completely steamrolling Whitney.
I mean, there's that. I mean, that was satisfying just to see Whitney get crushed.
Another one completely destroyed.
It's like, Blaine doesn't even need to do shit to just trounce, what's her name? Because he has Entei at that point. And Entei is just like, fuck really off, Claire! But no, there's like really cool fights in that. But yeah, like, fucking Price doesn't try to hide that he's an ice gym leader.
Not at all.
I don't know. I'm sorry. It just bothers me. I can't like put my thoughts on it because every time it bothers me. I want to talk about Silver though. Because Silver is an interesting character in this. Initially, I was kind of disappointed because, as I said, he doesn't follow the arc from the game. And that's a shame because Silver in Gold and Silver, the games, is easily the best character arc in Pokemon. Like, it was a character who stole everything, was only using Pokemon as a tool, was constantly losing, and from those losses learns to be, you know, he's humbled by it. He learns to love and respect his Pokemon, and it actually comes through in a very subtle way when his Golbat finally, you see, has evolved into a Crobat, which can only happen once a trainer has earned trust with the Pokemon. It was a really, really well-done way to kind of characterize and show the growth that Silver went through. In the game, in the manga, rather, he's not that really at all.
He's kind of like knockoff Blue to begin with.
A little bit, yeah. He has that, and then you start to see there's a little bit of green in him, too. Like, he has kind of like this... the vendetta. He has this vengeance he's going after. And essentially, as you find out, he was kidnapped like Green was, as we also discover, by the Mask of Ice when they were children and were kind of made into, like, grunts of his, like, part of his Legion army or whatever. And he's going after the Mask of Ice to get revenge for it. So he steals the Totodile. It's kind of why he does a lot of the stuff he does. But what's really kind of cool is they bookend Silver in the story really well done. Because the first attack that Silver makes is he gets his Totodile, he uses frustration. Because Totodile doesn't like him at all, and he's just kind of showing off, like, I can weaponize this. So he uses frustration with Totodile, kicks the shit out of somebody. The last real pivotal scene that Silver has on his own is him with his Feraligatr using Return on Will and completely just decimating him. And I was like, that was a really great kind of bookend to it. He, you know, starts the series using a move that was effective because his Pokemon hated him, ends it with one that shows how much his Pokemon cares about him. So it was really well done in that regard.
Yeah, Green gets a lot of development in this arc because it's established that she and Silver actually knew each other as kids and escaped from the Mask of Ice together. And they all finally close on her phobia of birds, yes, because they established, oh, you know, she had this trauma associated with birds when she was a kid. It turns out that the Mask of Ice, several years before, had taken control of Ho-Oh and used Ho-Oh to gather these children in order to make them into his followers. And so when Will and Karen, yes, the two Johto Elite Four members... This is their role in this. They ain't no elites.
It's the other gun to my head. What are the JoJo gym, like, Elite Four? Like, Bruno's one still for some reason, I think.
They, along with the two Team Rocket admins, are Price's most loyal followers. And they end up confronting Blue and Silver. Green and Silver at the end. And they have basically they've been entrusted with Lugia and Ho-Oh. And so they're using them against Green. And Ho is launching towards her, and they think, this will completely tear her apart. This is going to completely wreck her psychologically. The battle is ours. And she just stands there, stock still, as it flies past her. And she's like, thanks, now I've completely overcome the last of my phobia. And she throws out three Pokeball, and she summons the original three legendary birds.
Holy shit. Pretty fucking tits when she brings out the birds. Like, oh, shit! I know we kind of got it in the one movie, but it is just cool seeing the legendary birds from the first gen go against the legendary birds from second gen. It's pretty awesome.
All really cool stuff. And then we get the big finale, which is revealing that the reason Price did all of this is because if you get a feather from Ho-Oh and a feather from Lugia, this allows you to create the ball that can capture time.
The GS ball.
The GS ball. Which allows him to capture Celebi and travel through time without his body being torn apart by, you know, time-space continuum stuff.
Which I'm sure is considered a great thing once they actually get the Pokemon that can control fucking time and space.
At this moment, he has beaten Gold for about the sixth time in a row or something. Poor Gold. Although Gold did get a cool moment where he finally managed to destroy his mask.
Yes.
A cool combination attack. But this happens, and all of a sudden, these people, these recurring characters that have been showing up, like, it's what the daycare center workers.
The daycare center workers, I think, like, Mayor DJ Mary might be there, and the TV crew.
And one of them is Elm's assistant, and he delivers this envelope to Gull. He's like, it's a message from Professor Oak.
Okay.
Hold on.
All right.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You can continue. I may interrupt you, though, because I know where you're going with this.
All right. Well, the envelope says that, like, this, it's basically like this dissertation from Oak saying, like, you know, the people that I've entrusted the Pokedexes to all have these great expertises. Red is an expert of Pokemon battling. Gary is an expert on Pokemon training, Pokemon that are under him advance rapidly.
Yellow is the healer.
Yellow is the healer because of her magical healing abilities. Green is the evolver. She knows a lot about how to evolve Pokemon and specializes in it. Crystal is the catcher. She captures Pokemon. Silver is the trader, the exchanger, which they only really do, like, there's, I guess you could bring up the way he used frustration with Totodile, but other than that, it was like, well, he did one trade that worked out pretty well.
They had to give something, and they basically paired Green and Silver together, like, the Evolver and the Exchanger. These ones help unlock the mysteries of Pokemon. You're like, sure, whatever.
I mean, he did evolve two Pokemon in one go.
He does. He does do that.
So, but it's like, I'm not sure if there are too many ways you can weaponize that effectively.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, it didn't really seem that distinct. But oh, hold on a moment. Stand back, everybody. Okay. Gold's about to reveal his cool, super awesome specialty.
Well, because Gold is like, well, wait, that's it? That's it. Because he's looking through all the notes, like, these are the specialized. So you're saying that I don't have a specialty. I don't measure up to the other people who hold the Pokedex. And so I should just stay out of the way while everyone else goes after Price. It's like, seriously? That's what you want me to do? And while he's doing this, there's been this egg that he's been protecting through the battle with Price. That Yellow and Red's Pikachus showed up with. Because you can't say they had the egg, because that's not how breeding in Pokemon works.
They just found it.
We just found this egg near them after putting them together.
I turned my back and there was an egg all of a sudden.
You that in the manga, it's just like, we found this egg with them. So, yeah, Gold is frustrated over this. And suddenly the fisherman is like, wait a minute, Gold, there's this last page in the envelope that you didn't see. It's your expertise. You are the hatcher.
It is the lamest thing in the world when it happens. It is such a letdown in the moment.
It's badass.
It is so lame because he's like, your specialty is the hatcher. And the fucking egg hatches and Pichu comes out and fucking just surges him with electricity that causes him to go like Super Saiyan for a second and fly off. You're like, this is the lamest thing in existence. Like, you had all these fucking cool specialties, like the battler, the trainer, the catcher. And like, in the climax of this moment, you're like, and here's the hatcher who has hatched a total of 2 eggs thus far. And it's not that I'm necessarily pooping on everything, because they actually re-explain it in, like, a couple chapters later that I thought was awesome. They're like,
Pokemon under your air reach their full potential.
They're like, your specialty is bringing Pokemon into the world. And you can look at that literally as hatching an egg, but also just you help bring Pokemon into the world, into family, into that. And I'm like, that's cool. That I can get behind. It's in this moment when things are so fucking cool. Like, it's, everything's building up. Like, you're waiting for this huge moment that he's like, I hatch eggs, Pichu, let's go! And flies off. You're like, this is fucking lame. Pichu's lame. This fucking power's lame. All of this is lame.
I think that it would have been more effective if he was like, my specialty is hatching, let's go, Pichu! And they immediately go and beat Price. But they don't. They confront Price, and he's beaten off panel again. And he's gonna get saved by everyone.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't really ever get his big one-up on Price in that way.
Well, he does, at the very end.
Yeah, I suppose.
But it should have just been one thing where he's like, I had Jace, and then they get together, and then they go and fight Price. But no, he's like, oh no, Gold is trapped in time because he confronted Price on his own. Again! And lost! Again! But then they have this big thing where they have gathered the legendary beasts, who basically have been involved because Ho-Oh was the one who brought life to them. And Ho-Oh has been wronged. He's been captured by Fry so he could take advantage of his power in order to go after Celebi. So the three kids of this generation are set to go after Price, but they can't go after Price because he's got the only GS ball. And they're like, what do we do? And then Gold's like, come on, you guys. What the fuck? It's Gold, of all people, is the smart one in this situation where he just points at Yellow, who's got her hat on. He's like, look, the feathers on her hat are the silver and rainbow feathers.
I don't know why no one thought of it before.
Because like Team Rocket was going after her several chapters before.
Someone actually brought it up, too. They were like, wasn't it Green who specifically says, I hid the feathers in Yellow's hat to keep them safe?
And Gold is like, they're in her hat, guys.
You have to deal with like 5 fucking minutes of Yellow being like, no, no one can know I'm a girl. I get it. She's
No. Not no one can know I'm a girl. Red can't know I'm a girl because I've got a crush on him.
It's like, fuck, like, I get it. People out there, she's your fucking sticky bun or whatever horseshit you call these people, but
it's honestly a really cool little it's a cool little moment, honestly, when she actually does take the hat off, though.
It's decent. I don't mind.
It's just drawn well, I think.
Yeah.
But she takes her hat off, her ponytail comes out, and it's like, well, if you didn't want anyone to know you were a girl, you could have cut that.
Yeah, I'm like, just get rid of the ponytail. You hide it under a hat.
Exactly. And Red's just like, huh? and Gold's like, oh, you're a girl! Okay, we gotta go save the world! And meanwhile, Blue and Green are just kind of like, I knew already, and then saw Red. So they go off after Price, and Gold's just like, let's go, Pichu Thunder!
I'm reading it again, and it's still so lame. It's fucking Pichu, and immediately, like, look at this nonsense. Look at this. It's like fucking Pichu gets in there. You can see he's flying for some reason. Pichu, a Pokemon which has always been described as hurting itself when it uses its own electricity because it sucks that much. It's like all of a sudden, like sending him into like superpower territory, and I'm like, this blows. You had so many cooler characters.
So we finally get the truth about Price.
Yes.
The reason he was traveling through time is because he had a young Lapras, but the Lapras's parents died before his eyes, and he couldn't do anything to stop it. So he's gone through all this trouble capturing two legendary birds to make the ball that can capture time, to capture Celebi, to travel through time, so that he can travel to this one moment just so he can save his Lapras' parents. Mm-hmm. That's how much he really cares about Pokemon. And so, in the final confrontation, he and Gold have that connection, because Gold cares about Pokemon too. And he had been trying to convince Gold, oh, Pokemon are just tools for me to use, just weapons. That was part of his mask.
Yeah, that was, like, the cool part. He says, like, ah, Pokemon are only tools when Gold asks him. And then at that moment, it's like, I thought you said Pokemon were tools. It's like, no, everybody's a tool for this. Like, for me to get my Pokemon back. So you're like, oh, like, he's not just an evil dickhead. Like, there's, like, a human motivation behind all this. And that's, like, kind of satisfying to see. Because Pokemon, by and large, has been defined by having pretty generic villains with very kind of simple world domination plots, but this is one where you're like, oh, like, he's doing all this so he can...
He went through all that. Yeah.
Twice. Because this is not the first time he's attempted. That's why there's two feathers already. It's because the first attempt failed. So, it's a really nice kind of...
The reason why he lost is because when Green and Silver escaped, they took the feathers with them.
Yes. Yeah.
But then we have this really big, weirdly emotional climax where Price remembers a song that his friends wrote for him.
Yeah.
Okay. You can say that Pichu Lightning Super Saiyan is lame all you want. This is probably just as lame.
This is lame. It's just kind of weird because it sort of comes out of nowhere.
It really does.
They had shown this photo a couple times of the...
Kurtz and Oak and Price and
the Agatha and the daycare leaders. Yeah. Like, you didn't realize Price was in the photo before. He was, like, folded up on the side. And they reveal,
because
like,
he drifted apart from them. Because he was so obsessed with getting his Lapras' parents back.
So, like, at the end, the old daycare couple are explaining. He's like, oh, I used to be a part of a band. And, like, Oak wrote the lyrics, and fucking Agatha produced it. They all put a part into
the daycare song. Lady sang it. I remember that part because she makes a big deal of it. She's a bitch.
They all had some element of. Kurt and I wrote the lyrics. Agatha and Samuel made the music, and the old woman wrote it or sang it. And like they wrote this song for Price because of how sad he was.
And they wanted their friend to come back to them.
Yeah.
And it didn't reach him back then, but now as he's drifting through time because his GS ball has been shattered and he and Gold are about to drift away forever through space, the song reaches him.
And
he starts to cry, and it's like, oh, like that one panel of him just, he's like hang on to his wheelchair because he's been defeated, but he's got this just content smile on his face, tears are streaming down his eyes. If not for that one image, I think this would be much lamer than it actually is.
It's weird. It kind of comes out of nowhere, but it's effective. Like the point of it all is the execution. It's a well-executed moment. You have a chance finally to learn who Price is, to find out he's not a bad guy, that he's going to go through all of this hassle, use so many people just to kind of help his own Pokemon to like repair the one regret he has. And you see the humanity in there, and you're kind of glad he gets some kind of sympathetic return on it. Because he doesn't survive. Like,
he's dead.
Yeah, he falls into the
time
stream.
He's lost through time.
Yeah. And
Gold gets... I forget exactly how Gold comes back. I don't even know if they actually establish that. I think that's... Because he gives the feathers to Crystal and Silver so that he can keep on pursuing Price while they're going through time. I don't know if they actually establish how Gold actually gets back.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now. Gold doesn't say anything to that extent.
Which, honestly...
it gets kind of interrupted with him accidentally patting Green on the butt.
That was a weird moment. No, he's just kind of like... of course, because he doesn't know. Because he passed out during that moment. So he doesn't know how he got back.
Yeah.
But they don't actually establish how it happened.
I mean, from what I understand, they do... new versions of the story when they do like the remakes, like as a Fire Red Leaf Green, maybe
they don't remake the story, they go into new adventures.
So yeah, I don't know if maybe the
I forget if they do.
Are they completely new stories, or are they just like continuations?
They continue the story. Okay. Fire Red and Leaf Green is about Red and Blue going on a new adventure, basically.
Okay.
I don't know. And, that's something that I'll bring up. They establish, whenever a character meets Yellow, because Yellow's so young-looking, they have this running joke where it's like, wait, you're older than me? Because Yellow is now 12, and all of the new kids are 11. And that's something that actually continues through the story, is that all of the previous generation of kids keep on aging until, like, they're, I think, about to start running Sun and Moon. And Red is going to be something like 20. It's so weird to think that you could have Pokemon Paradise be that old, but it's something that I actually really appreciate, is that as these characters come back to be involved in the story again, they actually grow older and grow more mature in age. And you see a little bit of that in terms of how Red and Green and Blue are involved in this arc, and then they're going to come back again. And when they stand with, you know, their successors... It's so cool because, like, you actually have this lineage.
Yes. And I think that is actually a pretty cool element of it. So I'm looking forward to kind of seeing that grow. I like the way they utilize the protagonists in this one. They're in it, but they're not in it so much that they distract from the main cast. I was kind of hoping there'd be more of, like, a passing of the torch moment, but that might not be the kind of thing this series necessarily does. So it still ultimately was really effective in that. It managed to address some hanging plot points. You said they address the injuries Red sustained in the first part. You know, they explain Green and her fear of birds and give her some growth. But at the same time, all of the main cast actually finish up their character arcs. They all have their cool moments. So
it was really fun. I think that stuff gets a little bit less jump around as things go forward. And I think that that's probably the biggest weakness of this story arc, is that Gold and Silver just kind of disappear for a while. Crystal kind of disappears for a while. And I think that things become a bit more focused on, like, okay, Ruby and Sapphire are the focus in the Ruby and Sapphire arc, which I am looking forward to so badly. Because I do really like Gold and Silver and Crystal. But I think that this, in terms of the stuff that I've actually read, Ruby and Sapphire's actual whole adventure is the one that I like the best.
That has been pretty dope, because I love Gen 3.
I know you do. And you know, now that you've seen how the manga actually came up with this big, awesome plot out of Gold and Silver and Crystal,
mm-hmm. I'm pretty stoked.
See what happens when you've actually got something to work with, right?
Yeah.
That's gonna do it. I love Gold and Silver and Crystal. But I'm looking forward to talking about more of it with you.
The one thing I didn't get to mention, just because it didn't come up, but,
there's so much to talk about.
One, I didn't mention, it's the only time Crystal gets a Chikorita. It's the only time I've ever been like, oh, Chikorita's awesome.
Chikorita is so cool.
It's fucking adorable. It's so cute.
That's another one of the advantages of the art, is that the Pokemon look more relatable, mm-hmm. honestly. Like, when Chikorita shows up, basically, it just wants to go on an adventure too, because it knows that Cyndaquil and Sodile are out there. So it's trying to endear itself to Crystal. And there's this moment after it's been following her around where she, like, accidentally catches it. And she's like, well, I guess I have to take you back to Professor Elm. You want to come with me? No. Look, everyone on my team is super strong. And so Chikorita just goes, flexes one of its legs.
Yeah, you can see it right here. It's fucking Pokeball. It's doing a little flex because it's trying to show you it's super strong. But it's so goddamn cute and adorable. Like, oh, come on. Look at this. Look at this. It's fucking precious. But the other Pokemon I needed to mention, because it's the only time I could ever say this either, is fucking delinquent Togepi.
Oh my
gambles
God. Ever.
And vandalizes.
It's born while Gold is gambling, so it's actually how they set up his hatching thing. Like, when in big moments, they'll, like, actually inherit part of his personality. But he's cheating, he's hustling people at pool when it hatches.
Yeah.
So it comes out and it's playing dice and poker.
it's a shame, because it, like, just sort of disappears eventually, but I was like,
it's main battling Pokemon, yeah.
I could get behind gangster fucking delinquent Togepi so hard, like, you would not believe.
It does come back later on in the series.
Oh, sweet.
But unfortunately, Gold and Silver and Crystal, they do make more appearances, but they aren't as recurring as Red and Blue and Green tend to be.
I can understand that.
Which, that's understandable. Like, you can't just have the cast just eventually expand to 20 without rotating people out. But, yeah, I think that pretty much every character that, you know, deserves it ends up coming back. Except Misty never shows up again, by the way.
Oh, that's a bummer.
It's so weird. That's one of the things that, like, I briefly mentioned it, like, her feelings for Red develop. And actually, it's done in a really effective way when they first reveal it. They just show, like, Red just talking with Yellow and Misty seeing it. Mm-hmm. You don't see anything being said. You just know, like, oh, Misty feels jealous. And Eric is trying to encourage her through the arc whenever they have little talks. And at the end, she doesn't talk to Red about anything. And then she never shows up again. It's like, I mean, I'm not saying Ash and Misty forever, yo.
I'm just saying.
Why would you set that up and never address it?
It's kind of sad, too, because she has that moment when they've all lost, essentially, against the legendary birds. And, like, the legendary dogs kind of have to move on now. And she's, like, laying on the ground, kind of defeated, and she's like, I'm sorry, Erica, I lost that flower you gave me. Because she had this flower that Erica had gave her, and it's been destroyed.
She's like, use this to confess your feelings to Red, yeah.
And she's just like, oh, it's so sad.
And it gives you a double whammy, too, because she's thinking, like, well, I guess, you know, the Omanyte that I gave to Yellow and the Gyarados that I gave to Red are doing fine. This is my fate to just pass on Pokemon to other people who can take care of them better. So I'm sorry, Suicune, I can't be your last master. It's like, oh, Jesus!
It's like, can you fucking stop, dude? What's up with this?
And she never shows up again.
It's kind of a bummer. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed this part. I think this really did go a long way to showing what kind of potential this franchise has. It really does create an entirely different kind of story than you'd get from the games or the TV show. It's, you know, completely unique. It still has that weird kind of divorce from the game's mechanics, but it's not as large, and it's actually started to go a ways towards repairing it a bit. Like, in this, the gym badges aren't, like, mystical artifacts of power. They're like, hey, we have to establish, like, a gym leader.
What do they do?
Badges, and we're going to use them for a Pokemon League, so you can just get right in. So that's how badges are going to work now. So
you can tell, actually, that the games were developing because there's more to work with mechanically, too. Yeah.
And they...
he doesn't have to invent as much stuff.
Yes.
Just implemented in clever ways.
And they continue to kind of add those things in and add some more, like, they add the bits from the game in, like, day and night mechanics and breeding and, you know, the new evolution styles. Like, all of it's done really well, and I enjoyed it. Characters are fun. Crystal's great. I won't hear anyone saying anything differently.
And I like Crystal.
Yeah, so go check it out if you're interested in Pokemon. It's a pretty awesome read. Also, Annalisa, our good friend, is the letterer for these for this particular part. So you can check it out. The volumes I'm referencing, you can get these in like a pack together, and I think it's about $30 for the whole set, which is a really good deal.
Mm-hmm.
I will
note, 7 volumes.
Yeah, the box that it came in, it's like some fucking like breaking the rules of physics, because I have been completely unable to get them all back into the box afterwards since. They will not fit into it, so I don't know what kind of fucking devil magic they had to use to get them in there to begin with. But no, I highly recommend, if you want to check out the series, pick up the box on Amazon. It is a really good deal.
Was it like I warned you, where the last chapter isn't in that set?
No, it is. The last volume, if
you can see,
is a lot thicker than the other ones. You might not be able to see it from here, but the last volume is a little bit thicker. And essentially, like, you get to the end, and you start getting, like, the end of the volume bits, like, oh, here's where all the Pokemon are, all that sort of stuff. And immediately afterwards, then, like, here, like, you know, you get the supplemental material, like, oh, here's where all the characters traveled. And then it's like, boom, here's the last chapter.
So it must be like a special thing that they put together so that they wouldn't cruelly split the last finale chapter and stick it in the fucking Ruby and Sapphire volumes for some reason.
I believe that's exactly what they did. So, yeah, check it out. You get the complete story.
Annalisa says they redid the volumization. Thank you.
So it is extremely awesome.
All right. Well, we had a great time talking about this. Tune in a few more months for our next hour-long conversation about Pokemon. But for the time being, it's time for the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap, guys.
I'm a little bit bitter and angry at you, Nick, because as soon as we got into Blogist, so I was reading through Bleach to catch up on it, and I already knew at that point, I'm like, well, we just passed the goal. We're going
to have to cover Air Gear soon.
So as soon as that happened, you're like, all right, I guess we'll do the next Pokemon adventure. And I'm like, God damn it. So I'm going to have to read Pokemon Adventure then, and then immediately go into Air Gear, which is 30-plus volumes. And I was
like, after how much you like this, it's going to be like night and day.
And it wasn't just that, because you know what I held on to for the longest time? I was like, I'm going to get Nick back so fucking hard. As soon as we're done Air Gear, boom, JoJo Part 3, suck it. And I was like, God damn it, Halloween month's going to be happening at that point. You motherfucker, you're going to get off to like Thanksgiving.
Speaking of which, guys, start sending us suggestions now for Halloween month, because we're going to need something ready for that first week. Basically, once we're done with Air Gear, we're going to have to start reading the Halloween series. So get your suggestions going right now.
Yes.
WeekendMangaRecap@yahoo.com. With all that said, recap portion, let's do it. Going to start off with Black Clover, page 76, The Strongest Brigade. Last time, the Black Bulls, or those actually present in the capital, at least, decided to head towards the site of the battle on the Western Front. So we open up this chapter with Finral trying to flirt with a couple of girls until Yami and Asta and Charmy all loom up behind him. I actually really like the way that they're just kind of perched on his shoulders, looming as well. I did think that was cool. But, yeah, they drag him out so that he can teleport them away. And he's like, what's going on? No, you said that I could have the day off! Nope. when you die, you can have the day off.
Poor Finral.
So they head off, and we cut over to the Golden Dawn fighting against the Diamond Kingdom. Ino kicks some ass for a bit. That's really all you need to know.
Yeah, Ino's pretty sweet.
Sylph has a crush on Ino. That's her character. but then we get a bit more from some of the other members of the Golden Dawn. This guy uses his slime creation magic, but suddenly it's torn apart by another member of the Golden Dawn who bails this one loser out. And it's, I forget his name. I know that we know who it is because it's Finral's brother, and he's using spatial magic to rip stuff apart.
Oh yeah, I guess I don't remember this dude's name.
I don't remember his name, but that, I mean, that's who it is. And yeah, he's just as terrifying in action as we thought that he might be.
It's like almost horrifying. It almost looks like he fucking kills the guy until you're like, oh, okay, he did destroy that part he's actually in, but
right.
It looks pretty terrifying when you first see it.
I think that he takes the guy's arm off, though.
It's possible. Yeah, no, he does. He takes off kind of like his left side a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fucking brutal.
Violent as fuck. And then I wasn't really thinking that this guy would actually show up again, Lotus.
Yes, the smoke guy.
Yeah, the guy who's smoke magic. He's just kind of observing the action from afar. And he happens to see the captain of the Golden Dawn, who is using his plant magic and spreading roots all over the site of the battle. Just, they're growing out everywhere. So I like how he's eventually like, why did I have to notice this?
Well, I like that. He's actually showing himself to be like a really intelligent, thoughtful guy, like person on the battlefield. Like he's like, you know, beleaguering the fact that he has to, like, he's the one who knows it, so I have to call it in. But like, while all the other fucking big magic generals are like, oh, smash, smash, smash magic, he's the one guy who's like, hey, like, this guy's spreading his magic everywhere and it's kind of weird and powerful, so I think you guys should pay attention. I was like, oh, it's kind of like a cool role they gave him. Like, it's an admirable, respectable role he had. That was cool.
And he also observes that the captain is using other people's magic to create the spell as well, so it's going to be extra powerful. And at first he's just kind of like, huh, he's growing trees? Okay. Well, no one can make a spell big enough to cover the whole town on their own. Oh shit, he's going to cover the whole town because he's using other people's... Yeah. The captain then announces, now the great tree will bloom, and this huge tree starts to grow up from the sky. There's just this massive tree that essentially covers the entire town that they're in. World tree magic, great Mistiltian?
Mistiltian?
I don't know.
Mistiltian?
That's where we close the chapter. Just he grew a giant goddamn tree over everything. And there are several branches that look like they might have snatched up people, and are dangling them around, but it's kind of hard to see because we're pulled out so far.
Very likely. It's a decent chapter. It's kind of cool. Like, again, it's nice kind of getting a little bit of a break from the Black Bulls. You know, we kind of had a big arc with them, so it's nice to move away. Plus, it's nice to slowly start expanding this Golden Dawn main guy and start to get a little bit more of an idea about what these guys are all up to.
Uh-huh. All right. No Bleach anymore, so fairy tale time.
I do actually, that reminds me, I want to just point out, I'm going to completely blank on...
Yay!
On the name. Now I feel like a shit. hold on. I just want to look this up real quick. I want to give her proper credit because it was a really cool thing. She did the previous fan art for a couple of like the jokes we did in previous episodes. Reveal. I know it. I'm really bad at remembering names. Hold on. Let me just look this up real quick here, guys. I apologize. Ribblewroth. Sorry, that's it. Ribblewroth. She did a couple more images. It's particularly in regards to Bleach. Like, she drew, like, the Santa Uabach, and a couple other things. So just wanted to give a quick plug to her. I think it's really cool. You can check it out on her DeviantArt, which is RIVVILROTHE.deviantart.com. So very cool. Much appreciated. But yeah, it was kind of sad when I put up the poll this week and I didn't have to put up Bleach. I was like, oh, this is like a weird empty spot.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of sad.
Doesn't make sense. What's going on?
Yeah, nothing about this works.
No, I can't recognize anything anymore.
All right. Well, let's move on to a great series then, since we don't have Bleach to talk about. Let's talk about Fairy Tail Chapter 500. 500 chapters, Fairy Tail. It feels like it's almost been 3 whole years considering the pace Hero works at. Fire and Ice is the chapter title. And if you recall last time, Yuvia is super dead. She is crazy dead.
She is dead and never coming back, Chris.
Never. She's gone. So they don't want to start us off immediately into that fact.
Oh my god. If there was something that Fairy Tail could have done to make Nick a happy camper.
You wouldn't believe that. You don't want to start the chapter on it because it's too sad. It's too heartbreaking. You're like, oh, Luby is dead. I don't want to cry. So we start off instead with Brandis dropping Natsu and Lucy and them basically saying, like, we don't want to fight you. And Brandis is like, I don't want to fight you either. I'm letting you go, but I'm loyal to the Empire still. So this mercy, this kindness is only being given to you three. I will go after everyone else in your guild and I'm going to kill them. And it's not a threat. Like, this isn't a threat. This is truth. We are going to annihilate them. All your friends are going to die. Our guild mates are that strong. Like, this is how terrifying the Spriggan 12 are. I know you've beaten 70% of us already, but for reals, we are terrifying. And it cuts around to basically all the various members of Fairy Tail fighting, or not even just Fairy Tail, but like the Fairy Tail alliance with guilds, basically losing to the Spriggan 12 members, like Elfman and Lasana can't get past Ajeel. Jacob,
like, he just keeps saying desert, we can't compete.
Jacob basically just closes his eyes, and that's how he managed to counter Mira Jane having a lot of ripped clothes. But basically they just cut around and show that Fairy Tail's on the losing end of these fights, and she, you know, Brandis just keeps going on, like, you don't know how fearsome they can be. And we cut over to Gray and Invel. Was his name? What was this dude's name? The snow magic guy.
It was Invel.
Was it Invel?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I was mixed up with Ignell in my mind, which is Natsu's dragon father. Invel. And Invel's like, how could you possibly be alive? My magic should have... I mean, it was supposed to do just this, but you two both killed each other, so how are you alive? And he's like, well, whatever. Your wound... Because Gray's not responding. Gray's just so angry. He's like... Hur, hur, hur. And...
Fucking, he's like Cena facing it.
It is. It's not the best look. Yeah, it's exactly that. Just with heavy breathing, apparently. So loud and exactly. Oh, he's like, yeah, whatever. So what if you're alive? You're fucking... You huge hole in your chest. You can't possibly win this. And Gray just starts beating the shit out of him. Starts, you know,
Gray would punch a man with glasses.
He would. He fucking knocks that shit right off of him. And Invel comes out and he activates, I guess, what is essentially his strongest form of magic. A true ice divine general. It's his full suit of armor that he explains is demonic ice that freezes all it touches. So even Gray, with all of his resistance to cold, will be frozen solid by this. Gray instead just punches him and just destroys the armor. They explain that Gray is essentially putting ice on his arm to kind of cover up to basically match the ice general. And this is intersected then with Natsu's response to Brandish. So while Gray is basically beating the shit out of Invel, Natsu is continuing. He's like, yeah, but you guys don't know how scary Fairy Tail can be. So fucking Gray just clocks out Invel and KOs him. And we cut back to Natsu, who's like, we're fighting here of our own free will. So then Nineheart shows up. And you might have remembered Neinhardt had been with Irene a little bit ago, and he was kind of noting, like, hey, like, you know, not for nothing, these guys are a little bit intimidating. So she, like, filled him with this magic, and you can literally see it radiating off of him, and he's full of confidence now. And everyone's like, holy crap, like, I've never seen power like this. And he actually takes down Brandish. So he uses magic to start, you know, attacking her, because she was going to betray, like, she was negotiating with these, you know, these fairy tale members. So, in this moment, like, Brandish is like, how is he immune to my magic now? How is he so strong? I remade him this way. So, Nick, he is super duper powerful right now.
He's super serial, Chris.
And we have just met him. So what, of course, will happen?
Hang on, I know this.
Now remember,
we'll get an inappropriate cheesecake spread.
Close. Think, calm down, think about this. Fairy Tail just introduced a very strong villain with a power level that's supposedly higher than we've seen before. And he's in a situation where Natsu just made a speech about Fairy Tail.
He'll beat the good guys so that they can get stronger and develop.
No, that's what a good manga would do.
A good series. Natsu will make a friendship speech.
That's one part of it.
He'll punch him.
Yes. He will make a friendship speech and then punch Neinhardt and immediately defeat him with no effort whatsoever in a single blow. He fucking clocks him in what's essentially it's probably meant to be an action scene, but it just looks kind of comedic because Natsu isn't even look like he cares about the punch. Like, he's more focused on talking to Brandish at the time. Like, you can see it. His punch is, like, going, like, hitting Neinhardt like this, but his face and everything is pointed straight ahead, so he doesn't even care. Like, this is just fucking whatever. He's just like, because this is just one more step towards our guild being back together. Get out of here, loser, and just fucking clocks him. And you're like, why do you do this? Why did you bring back the Spring and 12 if you're just going to have them get clowned again? What's the point? And basically, that's that scene. Like, everyone's just like, wow, I can't believe how fucking powerful Natsu is. Cut away. Luffy is not dead, Nick. Shocker! A whole chapter went by, and she survived.
No, Chris. Not even a whole chapter. A whole chapter would have been if we got from the start to the end of a chapter, and she was still dead, or presumed dead. Didn't even give us 1 week...
She's fucking back.
I fucking love Fairy Tail.
Not a moment to let you sit in that doubt that she might have been fucking dead. She is immediately back because Wendy was there.
Could not have planned this better. Going, Chris, Juvia is dead and never coming back. Next week, Juvia is alive. Yes!
You never
let me down, hero.
It's astounding. So, Luvia is fucking making jokes about what it's like to be kissed by Gray, and then she's like, oh wait, where is Gray? And they're like, I don't know, he's not here. And we cut over, and Gray's still just, like, super angry. He's like, I keep punching you, but it won't bring her back! Nothing's gonna bring her back! So Invel, like, out of all of his, like I shouldn't even have a jaw anymore, is still, like, taunting him, which I think is kind of awesome. He's like, yeah! Neither is your mother or your father or your teacher. Suck it.
So now your girlfriend's gone. Your fish are gone. And,
your family's gone.
Nobody liked you in high school.
Your credit's bad. but he explains, like,
Everyone swipes away from you on Tinder.
Yeah, you never get any matches. You were deemed unfit for a match on eHarmony, which is something that actually happened in this place. Oh, that's so hard when he told me that. I didn't think that was something Match.com could legitimately do when it's just like, you're not fit for a fucking relationship. Oh, tangent. But no, like...
It's okay, Infamous, we love you.
Yeah. But Invil's basically explaining, like, we need you to destroy, like, you will be able to be the one to destroy End, because you're the only person that stands a chance of it, you know. End, Ethereus Natsu Dragnil, the greatest demon in the Book of Xerath, he is your true enemy. Dun, dun, dun. Don't give a fuck. Next series. This was an awful chapter of Fairy Tail.
I mean, I'm not saying that it was a bad idea to have Natsu and Gray kill two members of the Spring and 12 and then be told that they should be matched up against each other. That makes sense. But both of them are the dramatic, undercurrent of both of those moments is severely undercut by Nineheart never getting to look competent at anything. And no, Juvia is definitely not dead, guys.
You undercut everything with that sort of stuff. And I know they're trying to build into this idea of Natsu versus Gray being like a thing. And I get it. Like that Natsu and Gray were originally portrayed as real rivals to one another. And it worked with the fire and ice dichotomy of them and having very different personalities, red, oni, blue, oni sort of thing. But I don't feel like that's much of a factor anymore because their relationship isn't really rivalry in the same way it used to be. And I don't for a moment buy that Natsu has a dark side to him. I don't buy that even though he's the end, he's the Book of Demon Zeraph, I don't for a moment believe there's evil in Natsu. I don't believe he could be evil. It's the same thing when Gray showed up in the fucking villain council of Avatar where you're just like, I don't buy it. Like, I don't think he's actually turned evil. So when you try to pose this idea that Gray and Natsu are going to have a conflict, as it is right now, I don't buy it. There's no reason for the two of them to fight. There's nothing that, especially if the reason Gray decides to fight him is because he's like, Luffy is dead in some very indirect way because of you, when we already know she's alive. He'd have no reason to be angry.
I don't know. I guess we'll see where it goes, and it's probably not going to be very convincing.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
So we move on to Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 181, Becoming One with the Bear.
That's a great chapter title.
Oh my god. we get a pretty cool cover page of Kuga doing kung fu moves. Very bizarre, honestly. But also, there is no soul on that shoe. He is going to slip everywhere.
He's got
no friction.
He's got the spirit boots from Ocarina of Time.
Where when you start running, you just kind of run in place.
Yeah, you're like, uh oh. This is how I learned what traction was as a kid. I was like, oh, this is bad.
Oh my god, I hated whenever people would not take the hover boots off when they weren't necessary. It's like, what are you doing? You're just gonna skid in place. Weren't you?
Yeah, put on the iron boots and you look really cool stomping everywhere boom, durn, durn. Carry the megaton hammer.
Droll.
Yeah, carry the megaton hammer and just look terrifying everywhere you go. Hey, what's up, Chicken Town? Boom. I'm gonna make it rain, fuck you guys.
So did you just call Kakariko Village Chicken Town?
I knew it was some Japanese word, but I couldn't remember it. And I was gonna call it Karakura Town.
Then we're talking about Bleach for a second.
I was like, Karakura, no, that's Bleach, fuck. Whatever, Chicken Town. You have windmills and a chicken, alright? I feel like I've defined you by naming one of them.
Hey, all of Hyrule Village moved over here too once again and wrecked the place.
Yeah, and then I create a time paradox and fuck with your windmill, dude.
Except for the bomb chew girl. The bomb chew bowling girl. Apparently she's just dead.
They didn't need that sport. It was lame anyway.
It was the most bullshit of all of those little for the ranges.
Fuck bomb chews.
No one used bomb chews unless they were for a puzzle.
Yeah. And even then, you're just like, ugh. Puzzle.
They should have just been solved with bomb flowers anyway.
Yeah. They had a good thing going for them bomb flowers.
You could light them up. You could set them off with a Deku stick on fire. It was cool.
Yeah. And then sometimes, it's someone's first time playing the game, and they're just like, what does this do? And then they slash it, and they explode, and you're like, ha 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 ha. I laugh at your inexperience and pain. Older brother Mikey. This is a personal story that just became an anecdote.
Anyway. So last time, Soma was experimenting with bear meat. It tasted and smelled weird, and he was thinking about what ingredients he needed in order to actually experiment properly. Suddenly, Kuga arrived on the scene with his weird Chinese food followers, who all presented ingredients for Soma to use. They're doing weird kung fu stuff at the start of the chapter, so it was like, stop being weird! Stop it!
Yeah. I do like how Kuga, when he shows up, starts, like, going on, like, a long diatribe of, like, oh, well, I was so worried about you, because I knew you'd be all alone and crying because you didn't have me. And, like, Soma's just like, mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, you're not going to react? Like, for reals? Like,
so it's just like, no, you're always a drama queen. But Kuga says, oh, come on, I didn't come all the way up here just to mess with you. I'm actually dead. And so someone's like, ah, so you're here to help me. Great. And he's like, hold on a second. I have certain conditions. You must challenge Hayama to a Shokugeki for the 9th seat. So it was like, wait, what? Yeah. You're going up against the guy anyway, and you're going to get expelled if you don't pass, so might as well make it a Shokugeki. Go big or go home. So I was like, oh yeah, but for a Shokugeki, I would have to have, you know, a wager. Like, I don't have anything that he would want that would be equal value to a 9th seat position. He was like, well, details, just talk him into it.
He's like, you'll figure
you're
it out.
Good at that. But he's like, yeah, I'm sure Hayon would go for it. But someone says, "What? All right, but why do you care? Why do you want that to happen? Why do you care?" And he was like, because the Institute, as it is now, bores me. He has a flashback to a conversation he had with Rindo. But they're like, oh, you're going up to Hokkaido, huh? And Rindo's like, where have you been? He just grabs his cheek and says, where? But she's like, where have you been? Have you been off sulking somewhere this entire time? But Kuga says, look, I need something to keep me entertained. And I found some way that I can do that. And I've got nothing left to lose now that I've, you know, been kicked out of the council. So I'll do what I want. And when the advancement exams start, I'll screw things up for Central as badly as I can. And Rindo's like, okay, knock yourself out.
Well, I like how she says it, too. She's like, whatever does it for you, having fun is what this is all about for us, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of giving you a little bit of insight into why she's joined in with Central. So,
well, and also, there, Rindo was had known Kuga before this, too, of course. Mm-hmm. Existing relationship, and that offers a bit more of an insight into how they bounce off of each other. It's just, they're just kind of in it for mutual entertainment. And they've got points of view on how to get that.
I also kind of like that Kuga has essentially become like this joker element. Like, he didn't join with the council initially. He was presented as an antagonist, and we found out, he's not such a bad guy. He actually wanted to fight Tsukasa. He kind of was like Soma in a way. Then he's knocked off the council because we find out he's one of the three that didn't vote for it. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, we knew Ishiki, why he didn't. You kind of would assume, like, well, maybe Kuga had the same noble reasons. And in a way, maybe he does. But it's nice seeing, like, oh, well, Ishiki's probably out there doing something he can to help the Polaris or just the younger students. Like, you imagine he still has noble goals. Whereas Kuga's just like, I'm going to fuck with everything you do because that's what's fun to me now. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I'm just going to be a fucking fly in your ointment.
I kind of would sort of like if he recurringly showed up in this sort of role. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes in an antagonistic role and sometimes in a supportive role. Just but whatever way the wind takes him, kind of. Back in the present, Kuga presents a whole array of spices for someone to use. And he's like, oh yeah, go ahead, I'm doing this this is all for your sake. And, you know, once you beat Hayama, you'll be the new 9th seat. And then I can take you on a Shokugeki and beat you and take your place. And that way, everybody wins.
Such a roundabout logic.
And someone's like, I'm not sure if that's right. It's
like, well, it sounds like it would make sense.
But Kuga gives him the last bit of encouragement, so it's like, okay, thanks, let's get started on some practice dishes. You prepare something together, and Kuga's like, nah, this isn't gonna work, nah, blend's not up to par, come on, get it together. And so, Soma is like, okay, let's try this, some beer hot pot! And he explains what he's doing with this various spices. Kuga tries it out, he's like, yeah, this is good, yeah, you got rid of the smell really well, you've got the strong, rich flavor of the meat still. He made it work with the broth, too. And I'm not sure on all the details and stuff, but it's like, okay, he managed to neutralize the smell. But then he starts thinking to himself, he's like, okay, well, Haim's going to have some kind of berry dish that only he could make. If I don't do the same thing and find something that only I can make, there's no way I can win. And this would be so much easier, you know, if it weren't for this weird smell I've got to work around. Then he starts thinking, okay, but there are also foods out there that are considered delicious because they've got this weird, pungent odor to them. And maybe the bear meat scent isn't a bad thing. Maybe it's something that I should be trying to work with instead of working against. And so he thinks to himself, like, I'm not familiar with bear meat. I shouldn't be trying to fight against it, though. I've got to familiarize myself with it, and I don't know anything about bears. So he starts talking with Kuga, and he's like, you know, how did you start, you know, getting into Sichuan cooking? You know, how did you come to specialize in it? He's like, well, because my family's rich, so we would go on these overseas vacations, and when I was in elementary school, I thought it tasted good, so I started to just do it. It's just this image of him being this little brat with his fucking overalls. Someone's like, okay, I get it. You know, this isn't the way to go. I can't just rely on having all the spices I need to work with. I need to fully experience where a bear comes from. So Kuga gets his followers again. And he's like, okay, get everything needed for a mountain hike, a winter mountain hike, and get a full set of gear for Yugihira, and also get a proper professional services guide. He dispatches them all so that someone can set off into the mountains so that he can throw everything he's got into a dish and put it on a plate. But then we cut over to where Hayama is preparing and Dojima is observing him. He's like, man, he's better than I expected. He's way better than I expected. He has grown well beyond the chef he was during the Fall Classic. Yukihira, if you stay the way you are now, you won't stand a chance of winning. And yeah, badass pose of Hayama just dropping some spices into this burning dish while he smirks to himself. Really cool visual.
Very cool. I like this chapter a lot. It's cool.
Now, if someone has to go on a trek into the mountains in order to beat his opponent, what the fuck are the others going to have to do?
I don't know. We still haven't seen who they're... They said everyone in the Resistance had to go against a Council of Ten member. I don't know if all of them are going on at one-on-one fights. There's not enough members of the Council to facilitate that. But yeah, I'm curious what's happening.
Yeah.
I think we might have to pick up the pace here, since we talked about Pokemon a lot, so...
We did Pokemon a lot.
I will very quickly just note on Love Rush, not go into much elaboration, but essentially the last two chapters have been kind of like, oh, it's a nice change of pace for things, and then this is a chapter that's like, okay, harem stuff. Essentially, they introduce, like, the new member of the harem. It's a
check it out, Chris. The girl with the big tits is the shy one.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning development stuff. This might be the last chapter we ever get of Love Rush. If it is, I will say that I think this was a better series. It's a tremendous improvement over E-Robot. However, I'm not going to be too sad if we don't see any more of it.
My Hero Academia?
Yeah.
Number 105, Shiketsu High, lurking. We actually start things off with Uraraka recovering from the earthquake from last time, and she is going to try and regroup with everyone. Is going to use a new technique, sneak uravity. I want all of her techniques to just have ura in the title somehow. Anyway, Deku is fighting off against the Shiketsu member who had the vanishing thing before. He's already taken a hit to the target on his shoulder/chest. He tries to close in on her while she throws a ball at him, but she disappears again. She's like, what is going on? She tries to sneak in an attack from his blind spot, but he manages to dart away. Can't see her. Every time that he takes his eyes off her, every time that she's not attacking him, she manages to get away. And she doesn't explain what her ability actually is. She just says, yeah, this is my technique. All I'm doing is just hiding from your eyes and your ears. The moment I stop breathing and thinking, I can blend in.
Well, she specifically notes that it's not a quirk. Because
it's not a quirk.
She's, you know, Deku's thinking it must be some vanishing quirk, and she's saying, like, that's what you must be thinking. It's a vanishing quirk. No, this is just technique.
Mm-hmm. And she's like, what, they teach you? Yudeka says, they teach you that over Ishigetsu. And she says, well, the trick is not to see the training as training. I guess to just incorporate that into their being. But she also expresses a curiosity about Deku and is like, oh, I want to know all about you. You know, I want to know why you're trying to become a hero. But Deku manages to throw her off with his quirk. And more students show up and start to engage with them as well. Chaos erupts, and Deku is trying to get away, so they get separated. And all of a sudden, he hears Uraraka calling toward to him. And suddenly, Uraraka starts to fall when she turns to confront some of them and starts falling off of a cliff. And Deku catches her. And he, while he does so, he's thinking to himself, you know, way back then, when I fought, I blew up my arms, and if my arms hadn't been broken, I might have been able to protect Ka-chan. If I had succeeded there, maybe All Might wouldn't have had to fight All for One. If I'd carried Kota back to Aizawa-sensei, if I'd only run away faster than that villain could follow, maybe I would have been fast enough so that all this stuff hadn't happened. And so, in order to save others, I have to keep myself safe, and I've been training this entire time, focusing on my legs in order to get faster. So, a little bit of insight there, building on what we've seen from his training and his shoot style and stuff.
I actually really like that speech, too. It's like a cool, heroic speech. Like, if I could only have been there faster, if I could only have done this. Because that's always been Deku. He's always, like, even no matter how much he does, he's always thinking, oh, yeah, I could have done this, I could have done... He's like fucking Schindler at the end of it. He's like, I could have sold this ring! I could have saved more of them! It's very noble.
He also explains the way that the soles on his shoes work. I like, they've got a blowback function in them, like a gun, but the way he expresses it is, it's not just a single bam, but a doubled ba-bam. You dork, Deku. he manages to get away with Uraraka, and they take cover behind a big old, shard of rock, and Uraraka's like, I'm sorry I'm so clumsy, and Deku's like, nah, it's okay. Never mind that for now. And Uraraka suddenly takes the ball out and is going to attack Deku from behind. But Deku spins around and knocks it out of her hand, and she's like, yeah, you're from Shiketsu, aren't you? And she's like, wait, what? Well, Uraraka's been training her quirk, and so she's able to ignore the side effects for a short time and make her own body float. And in a pinch like this, she wouldn't just forget to use it, and she wouldn't just reveal herself to the enemy without a plan. You're not the Uraraka I know. So, cool moment, also compounded by the infiltrator saying, what, but you saved me anyway? Were you hoping to use me to your own advantage? And Deku says, nah, I just, you know, figured that since you're not Uraraka, you couldn't have floated yourself to safely, so you could have fallen and hurt your back if I hadn't caught you. It's like, aw, Deku, you're such a hero, man! But the disguise literally melts away and starts to reveal the true identity of the presumably Shiketsu student. This is, according to the little verbal tick, actually the same person who attacked him earlier.
Yeah, she seems to have a...
Because she goes, you've got to let me know you better, so...
She, I think, has been a really effective character. I don't know why. There's something, like, very, like, hypnotic about her, almost. Or, like, kind of, like, hard to, like, look away.
It's her eyes.
It's that, and I feel like Horikoshi has really established himself between her and Touga as being able to create really creepy and engaging, like, yandere weirdos. And I like her a lot. I actually like her uniform. I think... I don't know. Maybe it's the cat suit. Maybe it's like the fucking military, like the like fucking supervillain hat, like the M. Bison hat or combination of it. I'm just like, that's a cool outfit. But yeah, no, I liked it.
One Piece, chapter 838, Chobro. Last time Luffy sent Cracker flying with his Gear 4. And he vows he's going to go and see Sanji. And this time, Cracker attempts to repel his attack, his Kong gun, with his lance, but Luffy just blasts right through it and essentially destroys him, just wrecks his entire body, which breaks apart until this smaller man pops up out of the shell and slashes a sword, which digs into Luffy's armored arm.
This is something I've been waiting to see for a while in One Piece. It's something a friend of mine brought up when we were doing, like, One Piece role-playing at times. He's just like, I've been waiting for a time when somebody, like, Luffy missed somebody, and they just took a knife, stabbed it into his arm, and just ran it alongside his, like, outstretched, opened arm. And this is not exactly that, but it's like someone's attacking Luffy's outstretched arm, and he's not in, like, he's not immune to slashing, so it's just like he almost gets fucking dismembered right there. He's just like, he returns his arm. You can see how far the blade gets into him. It's like, oh, that's pretty fucking brutal.
And so we're introduced to Cracker, the real Cracker, who is this little guy with an incredibly difficult to maintain, presumably, hairstyle. Just, but he says, you know, I'm impressed you managed to actually break my armor. He says, I guess I already introduced myself. I'm Cracker the General, but, you know, this was actually my armor. See, I'm a biscuit man with the powers of the Bis-Bis fruit. I can produce and manipulate an infinite number of biscuits. I just craft the outline with crushed biscuit dust. Just set your mind to it, and look, it's the face of a hardened warrior. Biscuits change their form depending on the era and the creator. Not many manage to catch a glimpse of my true self. In fact, the bounty poster printed by the government only shows my armor, not me. And he then proceeds to summon a horde of the armors that Luffy just struggled to take on. Oh, shit.
It is supremely cool. When he started explaining his powers, I couldn't help but thank my friend Frank, who I've mentioned before, the guy who got me into manga. He had always joked about what if he joined the One Piece role-playing group I was in at the time. He was like, I'd want to have a Logia, and I know they normally don't allow it, but it'd be okay if I have a bread Logia, and I just have different bread-based attacks. And it was always just a joke for him, but I want to tell him, like, Frank, there's a cookie devil fruit now, and it's badass!
Oh, man. Luffy tries to take on, like, half a dozen of the armors at once, and he manages to break through some of their shields, but Cracker just commands them forward, and they just start advancing on him. And he's weaving his own attacks in alongside them, and Luffy's getting beaten up before we cut away. But, this is getting me really excited, though. You know, an opponent who seems to actually be leagues above Luffy even after all of his training now. Now it can start getting into, like, some real big, important stuff.
The Four Emperors are establishing themselves to be a pretty big jump up over the Warlords.
We cut over to where Nami is briefly, and so she's confronting all of the trees around them, and she's like, ah, Cracker the General or his mother Big Mom, and I've got her, you know, her script here. Well, I wonder, which of them is scarier? And she makes this face. Nice. They're like, you're scary! But then we cut over to where Chopper and Carrot are inside of Brulee's mirror world. And she's like, Carrot, listen to me. I have an idea for us to escape. From this point onward, you must call me Big Bro Chopper. And she's like, okay, what's your idea, Chobro?
Oh, he's like, I wanted to be Big Brother Chopper.
But Chopper actually comes up with something pretty clever, which is the world within the mirror, it's not just, like, in one mirror. It's actually connected to various different mirrors. Yep. So we shouldn't be trying to escape this place. We should be trying to use this to our benefit. We should be trying to escape from this world through a different exit so that we can actually get to an advantageous position. So, cool stuff.
Yes, I like that.
We also get a brief little catch-up with Brooke and Pedro, who are hiding inside one of the biscuit soldiers in order to move around the city undetected. And then over to Big Mom, who's basically just kind of talking with her followers about random stuff, about the wedding, asking what her mold spores are up to. Having a conversation with her hat, which the Jolly Roger symbol is like moving to talk with her. I like that.
I like the hat being like her fucking, what was the name of like the little puppet dude, in Power Rangers? Like the one Rita always had, not Goldar, but he had like,
Inster.
Finster, like her Finster, like she's just like, give me a status report, and the hat's like, let me tell you.
And then what was it, Squatting Babu with the two nincompoops?
Yeah. It's pretty sweet.
Then at the, we cut over to the port where the last of the Vince Smoke's sons are arriving, Neji and Ichiji. I guess these are the two big deal sons out of the family.
Yes.
Looking really weird, as all of Sanji's family does. But we also see Sanji, like, miserable and shivering up by himself. And it's notable because, you know, these are two of the guys who would beat him up when he was a kid, too. So. Yeah.
It's interesting. Actually, the only thing I want to note is that Big Mom also specifically is asking about how the Straw Hats are doing. And they note, like, their chances of contact are essentially zero. So she says, like, oh, so they're just talk like all the others, referencing mm-hmm. what we learned last week, that this is right. not the first time a supernova's challenged her.
They also, by the way, also, Ichiji is, his title is Sparking Red, and Neji's title is Electric Blue. And it just, that just makes me think of the Electric Blue and Red Superman from the 90s, those ill-conceived characters.
Oh, fun time.
But after all that info dumped, we're not going to get One Piece next week.
It's a bummer, but
yeah,
it's fine.
We'll talk a little bit about Promised Neverland. Not sure. There's not a whole lot really to make note of. They're doing information gathering.
It's actually a kind of interesting chapter because Ray goes on this big explanation of kind of showing what they know. And we learn from this that this is set in our universe. It's set in our Earth because he shows a map of the world from 2010 and specifically notes like it's 2015 and how he's learned from all the books and things like that now that there's no possible way that they could have had a chip that was implanted into them that wouldn't leave any kind of scar or anything like that. It's just scientifically impossible. So the only possibility is it may be something of the monsters of their design. And the entire time, basically, they've been forced to do chores for Mom. Like, they have to do cleaning duty. And
all five of the oldest kids, the three of them included.
Yeah, and they're just noting, like, she's just trying to keep us busy so we can't go around and do anything. And they're discussing plans, and they're trying to think about how they can outsmart her. And they note, like, how they used to... She was their teacher. She was their mother. And they note, like, she was their mother, but also our teacher. And it specifically shows them playing chess against her. All three of them against her. Like, she raised us. She taught us. And, what's the white-haired kid's name?
Norman.
Norman is noting. He's like, yeah, it's sort of weird. Like, they just keep setting us up for this. Maybe it's nothing. And then finally, they're like... Oh, hey, you guys aren't on chore duty anymore. And that's when they see Mom coming in, and she has a new kid, which is earlier than expected, and another adult. And they're like, shit.
Crone.
She got us. She had us thinking the entire time, overthinking essentially the tracking device and why we were being forced to do work. And that was also she'd have enough time to essentially bring in a second adult. And they intersect that with Mom playing chess against them again and saying checkmate, and they're like, oh, it's like you know everything we're thinking. She's like, of course I do, because I'm your mom. So they are in a dire situation mm-hmm. now because there's a second adult in the house.
Yep, that's pretty much it. Also a little bit of character development with Emma kind of having a bit of a Sakura thing where she wants to be just as great as Norman and Ray are. Although she's a main character, so she's not going to punch an enemy and then have them go past her anyway.
Yeah, she'll actually probably be important. I want to note Red Sprite, because we didn't get to talk about it at all mm-hmm. last week. I thought actually the first chapter for this was really good. It was kind of interesting. It has an issue with it because it had to unfortunately come 2 weeks after Promised Neverland. And the issue is that they have very similar kind of feelings to them. They both start off in orphanages.
Yeah,
in situations
they do.
That are kind of bad. There's, like, a heroic of trying to save everyone from these bad positions. Mm-hmm. Children's being used as a fuel or food source of a kind. But I think if you ignored that, it actually is pretty, well, you know, pretty strong series. It's nothing spectacular. It's nice that it has a different aesthetic. You know, it's kind of steampunky, Final Fantasy-ish technology.
Tomohiro Yagi did a cool but very short-lived series before this called Iron Knight. Mm-hmm. which was about a kid who would turn into this metal-covered demon with fire powers and use the two different powers in cool ways, but that one was, like, you know, canceled basically as soon as it could have been, unfortunately.
And what I like about this, the main character, Tatsu, like, Tatsu Funk, or something, like, as German of a name as you can get, he's not particularly deep or anything like that, but what I like is he has this goal, and it's like, I'm saving my six friends that were taken from me to be used as a power source. I'm going to save them. And I don't know, it's just a sucker in me. I love, like, the getting the gang back together kind of stories, or, like, the I have to go out and find my, like, I have to go out and rescue a certain number of people. Like, it's just, you can put those characters in unique situations, have every rescue be its own unique entity. This is, like, a story that, I mean, I don't know, it might not last very long, but I think this is a story that could function as a short story of 20 chapters, or this is something that could turn into a sprawling epic. So, the second chapter isn't as good as the first, but I think that's sort of par for the course.
It's the first rescue.
Yeah. And it makes sense, we're kind of going the one character of his friends that actually got any development in the first chapter. Mm-hmm. You sort of had to have this chapter, though. Like, you
don't, and also, presumably, might have a higher potential than his, too. Because she, they noted, has... They have the evil organization, the evil government, has this means of detecting, like, wavelengths and stuff, and hers was stronger than all of the other kids. So okay. She could have a higher potential than Tatsu's.
Is it a she? I thought it was a he.
She's wearing a corset.
Momo? That doesn't mean anything. This is... This is anime. It is manga. It's Japan. They'll put boys in anything that's traditionally seen as women's clothing, and they'll make you feel weird for thinking
otherwise. I'm going to call her a girl and so proven otherwise, which could very well be next week. Yeah. So
I think it's a he. I don't know. I might be wrong. Anyways, though, I thought this was a...
takes off a straw hat.
I'm just like, oh, god damn it. She's like, well, I heal people with my tears. I'm like, oh, it's fucking cinematic.
I don't want my nonsense. Pokemon to evolve.
But anyways, it's a decent series. It's not great, but I think it's decent. I don't know if it'll run in the magazine. Probably not. They already picked up Promised Neverland, but you never know. If you guys like Red Sprite or Love Rush, make sure you vote for it in the survey, which you can find at the bottom of like shonenjump.com. It's at the very bottom, usually like where like support center links are. I don't know why they put the one link to the survey down there, but that's where you find it.
All right. Let's move on to Toriko. Gourmet 385 Midora's Full Course Meal. Last time, of course, Midora joined the battle, knocked Akechi around after getting pissed off because he was being a sexist fuck towards Froze. Then Pear said, hey, undo the Nakayami. I'll help you guys. And we pick up actually at that moment with Brunch being doubtful of him, but Toriko gets up and says, I don't think he's lying, so I think we should trust him. But then we cut away to the fight that's going on. Midora is still battling with Akechi. Akechi, from his prone position, launches a massive gourmet punch towards him, and Midora just says, Minority World, deflects it back at him. And he's like, yeah, picked this up for my brother, bitch.
Yeah. Pretty pimp, right?
But then he turns and he sees Joey flying towards him and he says, there's no dodging this! I've already hit you, in fact! And tries to use a Satan hole technique, which does nothing. And Midora just coldly looks down at Joey and starts to talk and says, my first encounter with Froze, that's the appetizer of my full course meal.
Is this... so cheesy and this is so cool. Awesome.
And Joey is trying to attack him with all these different techniques and none of them are doing anything. Froze is caregiving. That's the soup. My first taste of soup is something I'll never forget, even after I die. And the fish dish is my first experience of family warmth.
You have to understand, as he's going through all this, she's trying to kill him. She's, like, shooting acid at him and filleting him, and he's just sitting there, and he's like, her kisses
were my meat dish.
So you and your Oedipus complex, Satan bomb!
I love that she's literally insulted him too while she's like, you and your fucking mom complex! And he's still
the
just
the meat dish of my full course meal. No, shut up! Was how she always smiled warmly at me. It's Froze's smiling face. That's my main dish. And Froze just eventually like, fuck this! Food luck! And how, no matter what, she was always on my side.
I love it. She's like, food luck, food luck, food luck. She's like sweaty.
Focus and encouragement. I will never forget it. The salad of my full course meal.
Just shouting it. Like, food luck, food luck.
And yet she never failed to put me on the right path. Froze's teachings are my dessert. Did I use too much of my food luck? It's run out? Froze was always there. Shut up!
She's like, God damn it, food luck!
Whether it was my family members or strangers, it didn't matter to her. She even accepted and took me in and taught me the most wonderful flavor of all. Love. Before I knew it, my stomach and ravenous hunger yearned for Froze's cooking. That and nothing more. Upon her death, my hunger was less destitute. The irritation couldn't find an outlet. And the constant hunger with no end in sight moves me even now, as ironic as it may be. And Froze wanted with all her heart for peace. Everyone smiling and gathered around the table, that was her dream. And so as a last resort, Joey suddenly turns completely into Froze, like all the markings on his face disappear. And she just smiles and says, that dream will come true, Midora. I'm sure you'll feel satisfied once more. I'll make sure of it. And this is just a distraction because Acacia comes up behind him.
I don't think it was a distraction. I think she... maybe I'm mistaken. I think she actually did turn into him. But maybe I'm mistaken.
I think that it was a deliberate attempt.
I don't want to make this the bubble fruit again. You're right. I'm sorry.
Acacia comes in, tries to attack Midora from behind. But suddenly, Toriko comes flying in and punches him in the face and sends him flying! And Midora says, you're a fool for repeating yourself and never learning. Having Acacia come save you is your final helping of food luck, wasn't it? But having Toriko show up was my food luck. You're really unlucky. And suddenly, Joey starts to disintegrate gradually, and Midora says, my full course will probably never come together. Because sharing a meal with my family, which was Froze's purest of pure dreams, was the last item in my full course meal. The drink.
It's kind of sad when you think about it.
It really is.
He's essentially the last member of his family, because Jiro's dead, Ichiru's dead, he's now killing Froze, who was already dead to kind of begin with.
And Acacia was always a dick.
Yeah, the goal is to kill Acacia, so like he's... Not only is he not going to be able to share the meal with his family, he has no family left to speak of, really.
And Joey starts begging for mercy and saying, look, my body was originally Froze's, and if you erase it, then you'll never be able to get your full course meal together. You could find Froze's soul, and your dream could still come true. And even while doing that, tries to launch one final attack, which Midora just shrugs off again, and he says, like I said at the beginning, my full course meal is a memento for the afterlife. If you meet Froze on the other side, let her know. All my memories are in my belly, and even now, they're getting better with age. With the same unchanging flavor and taste, my body will continue to be satisfied. And he just turns and walks away as Joey continues to disintegrate.
It's a pretty fucking badass moment, too.
This was so cool.
Midora is fucking awesome.
Getting this big Kenshiro moment all of a sudden. This big emotional speech about what Froze meant to him while shrugging off all these attacks, and then you are already dead as he walks away.
I love how he just doesn't give a fuck of any of the things she's doing. Like, she's shooting acid at him and fucking filleting the planet around him, and he's just like...
Anyway,
bath time with you was my fish dish. Always so tender the way you scrubbed my body.
That one time I came into the room while you were changing. Oh my god, stop!
He's like, this has gotten a lot less endearing and it's just weird. He's like,
the fan fiction I would write of the two of us frolicking together in the field, no longer bound by the societal standards that the world has for us. Mother and son holds no place for our love. That is the drink of my full course menu, to quench the thirst of my penis. I'm like, all right, this is too far now. Just kill her. Just kill her and be done with this.
I love this chapter, though. It's so cool.
It's very cool.
World Trigger.
World Trigger!
Chapter 156, Kazuaki Oji. Oji is the last remaining member of Oji Squad, still chasing after Osamu and Chika. Having a much better time of it than Asimai did.
Yeah.
The announcers basically point out, Chika and Osamu are trying to race towards the wire zone, while they'll be able to have the advantage. Zo expresses surprise. He's like, I thought that Oji would actually just keep going after Oki. I'm surprised that he broke off. The other says, well, Tamakoma's fate is determined by whether or not Chikako can outrun him, because their strategy can't fully come together unless they have a sniper in the wire zone in order to cover people. If they lose her, then Tamakoma can't perform the winning formula demonstrated last
time. The wires are easy to deal with if it's just Yuma they're worrying about, because you could just destroy them. But
right. A
sniper makes it so you can't sit there and try to take those out.
And something he points out is that, okay, Four Eyes here, he has to make to do this, because Oji is trying to contain Chika with Hound using his right hand, and he's doing this so that he can stop her from using the lead bullet, meaning he can only rely on his left hand. And so someone's like, okay, if I'm only up against just his left hand, then I can stop him. And Oji goes, just immediately says, were you just thinking just now that you could make a stand against me because I'm not fully focused on you? Not that I'm trying to underestimate you or anything, but you're just not that strong.
Oh, I love this line. I mean, I love Osamu, and it hurts because it's fucking cutting, but I love it. Not that I underestimate you, but I'm afraid you're not that strong after all. And he just fucking goes through and basically just kills Osamu.
He immediately dashes past him and cuts Osamu's arm off while he's going. So Osamu has to quickly turn his thruster on in order to get back between he and Chika. Tries to use red and invisible spider wires trick that he used in the last match. And Oji just says, this isn't that big of a deal. And
takes out Osamu. Just fucking...
Yeah, Osamu tries to use his asteroid as well, and Oji just closes the gap, grabs him by the throat, and sends a blade through his palm to pierce through Osamu's neck. And takes him out. So Chika's left on her own trying to deal with Oji and try to get away without any backup until Yuma can get there.
So, here's the thing. I'm seeing some people in the chat even commenting like, oh, Osamu just lost to somebody else. That's not the point here. Like, Osamu lost to Oji, and that makes sense. Oji's the ace on their team, and Osamu is never going to be at the skill level at the ace, or maybe not anytime soon. But this was a decisively different round for Osamu than when they fought against Kagayura and Ninomiya. He didn't get eliminated first. He accomplished things. He got a point before he went out. He managed to protect Chika, even if it was for a little bit, and he set up a wire zone. So
to his strengths all the way to the end.
He did it. So we don't even... We'll still have to see what happens in these next few chapters, but the point is that Osamu didn't do nothing in this. The wires that he left behind might still be the key deciding matchup in their victory. So that's what Osamu had to prove himself to do as captain. And I think he looked cool in there. Like, it's... Yeah, he gets kind of clowned, but that's the character of Osamu. He's not the ace. So other aces are going to make him look foolish, but he succeeds in other ways.
Yeah. He's not trying to beat the guy. He does get a little bit carried away, obviously. Because he's like, oh, he's just got one hand, then yeah, I can hold the guy off. And the guy's like, no, you can't.
it's such a cold way, but like not mocking in a way. I just love that way. He's like, I'm not underestimating you, but you're not that big of an issue, and just fucking goes right through him.
And Toma says like, yeah, and Amatori doesn't have a chance here. He'll just keep on pressing her, making sure that she can't use the lead bullet. and Kuga can't get help her from this distance. He's too far away, so, you know, nothing can be done about it. If Kuga's not there, they're vulnerable. That's Tamakoma's weakness. Which, presumably, they're going to get another ace soon, yeah. So there you go. But Chika suddenly, while still keeping her shield up, declares Hound. It's a giant hound behind her. And everyone's like, holy shit, there's no lead bullet. It's just a regular hound. And Oji says, she's not going to use it. It's a bluff. She can't shoot people. And she can cast her hand out. Blows up the entire ground between them. So, she didn't shoot him, but she still used it. So but
it's actually kind of cool, because that, the just destroying the ground wouldn't have been enough. It's that she made him, not hesitate, but she made him think, like, oh, he won't possibly, like, she's not going to, because she won't shoot anybody. So when she does fire, you see, I think for a moment, he's surprised by it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he might have been able to find a way to counter it and still go after it.
He thought that she wouldn't unleash it at all.
Yeah, but for that moment, he's like, oh shit, I was wrong!
So she manages to just buy herself a little bit of time by disrupting his line of sight with the explosion and manages to finally reach the wire zone. And Yuma reaches it as well from a different angle. So, yeah, now we've got both remaining members defending themselves in the wires that Osama had set up. And Yukoma squad reaches there and they're like, there's so many goddamn wires here.
Motherfucker, that dickhead really has been shooting these things off, hasn't he?
And, just as they observe that Chika uses her cannon, to blast, their position, so they're like, oh, okay, take her out! And she deflects it with her shield because she's got so much goddamn trauma.
God damn it.
So he's like, shit, I've got to wait for her to shoot before I can actually hit her. She'll just keep the shield up. So they're like, okay, what are we going to do? And Ikoma says, we're going in. We don't have a point. this is still to Tamakoma's advantage because Ikoma's got to engage. Oji still only got himself to rely on. And, so
the squad has no points. So the whole thing they're kind of hitting on is like, what's OG going to do? Is he going to go after Osama or Chika and Yuma, or is he going to go after the three members of the other team and try to hit them on the other side?
And so they basically establish this is the situation as it stands now. These are the positions. This is the score, and this is the final phase of the battle that we're going into right now.
Very exciting. This is a really cool chapter. I love the moment Chika gets. I like Osamu putting up a struggle, but I also really like OG. Like, OG squad hadn't looked cool in this matchup until this point, so OG kind of need that moment to be like, oh shit, like, now I see why you're, like, the ace on one of the highest ranked B squad teams. So, that was a really cool chapter, kind of gave everybody their due focus. I like the analysis that went on. Really effective.
Alright, I guess that's gonna do it. Let's wrap things up.
Yes.
MVPs and series of the week. I'm going to declare One Piece my series of the week for the big moment of Luffy is in big goddamn trouble. Been waiting for this basically since the moment that they actually got to the new world, so to speak. That's kind of.
One Piece was very good. I actually am going to give it to World Trigger. I really enjoyed that chapter. I thought that was a really fun chapter with a lot of really good development all around. I also consider Toriko as well, and One Piece is, it was very good. Food Wars.
One Piece wins our viewer poll this week. World Trigger is the runner-up. So not too surprising, honestly. And Midoriya is my MVP.
Yeah.
Because, holy shit.
Midoriya is my MVP as well. He's extremely awesome. I'm starting to worry now that when that end of the year thing comes around, I'm going to be like, tell me Osama was my most picked. You're like, actually, you picked Midoriya like six times. Because I'm pretty sure I picked him at least twice already. Don't tell me now. It has to be a surprise for the end of the year. But
let's see.
I'm a little worried. That's mine.
All right. Let's wrap things up then. Thank you everyone for joining us here for Weekly Manga Recap. We tend to record the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or maybe a little bit later, depending on stuff. So, to stay updated on when and if we even need to change streams where we're going to stream the show from. Check us out on Twitter. For the podcast, you can follow at WMR Podcast. You can follow the hosts individually at Royalty and at Y Roger of Time. Be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Subscribe to us on YouTube, subscribe to us on iTunes, and make sure to leave a comment or rating to help us beat the woodworking podcast in the hobby section.
We need it. It's an uphill battle every week. And we need our valiant soldiers out there, the WMR Legion.
The Upvote Army.
The WMR Youth, as I like to call them. Like, let's not call them that.
Anyway, special thanks to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of fun bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We're going to be doing a Q&A episode pretty shortly, I think.
Yes, we're going to be doing one in a couple days. We're going to be doing, for this month, our bonus spot, we're going to be doing a new episode of Weekly Manga Recap Lives, which is where we live act, voice act a couple different chapters of various series throughout the past couple months of the magazine. I actually have put up a poll now. You can see it. If you go to hitbox.tv, it's there. It's also there up on our Twitter. It's a straw poll. Vote for like three of the series that are up there that you would like to see us do a chapter on or performance on. I might actually also kind of increase the production value on this a little bit, maybe add music and things like that, sound effects and post. So there'll be some cool stuff going in with that. But we always have a lot of fun with this. It's always one of the cool, really enjoyable bonus pods to do. So make sure you put your vote in for that. I'm shocked, actually, that Fairy Tail isn't getting more attention, because I thought everybody would love to hear us do the Spriggan 12 returning, but maybe I was alone on that thought.
But, oh, boy.
Yeah, no, go check that out. And also, I want to give a special thanks to Matthew King, to Jacob Gray, Leswick Wykowski, I believe, Philip Pham, David Lay, and Farrell the Gecko, who are our new patrons. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much, all of you. It is a huge benefit, and we appreciate it very much that you're supporting the show. So, fist bump to you.
Apparently a bunch of Marika fans, because not too many votes for Nisekoi.
No.
A little taunt at the end.
Suck it.
Oh, man. Yes. Where was I? I lost my face. Shit.
Our friends who help us out with the show.
Steve Mann and Infamous Planet, thank you guys so much for helping us out for all the fun little visual stuff going on. Like, made the title card for gold and silver right here. Nice. And also the frame you see around you, of course. All right, guys. It's going to take us a little while. We're not going to do it next week. We're probably not going to do it the week after.
It might not be until the end of the month. Here's the thing you have to understand. Air Gear isn't just garbage, it's garbage that ran for like 9 years. So there's 30 volumes plus of this to get through.
And I'm on chapter 3 right now.
Yeah, I read a good portion of it and I'm still going to be like, God, it's going to take forever. So,
and I'm already like, oh, this is going to be bad.
Oh, I'm telling you, Nick, if you're agonizing now, I don't know what to tell you, because this is the highlight of the series.
But we are going to start the countdown now. Get ready, guys. It's coming. Weekly Manga Recap review of Air Gear. And I'm pretty sure that when we talk about that, we might not talk about any other manga. Oh, man, this was brilliant. Fairy Tale. Just nothing but pinups this week. Love it.
Oh, it's so great when there's fan service that doesn't imply a lot of rape at the same time. Oh, I love it so much. Hero, you're great.
Look forward to it, guys, because it's coming.
It's coming.